Hello and welcome to Radio Estina. We're going to play a couple more songs and then we're going to start in with the commentary. And today we're going to talk about Social Security and some overt discrimination against white males and the documentation of that we have from a listener. Then we'll move into a little bit about who I like to call Uomo Floresi, who is the little tiny subspecies of man or little type of man that developed in the wilds of the South Pacific, I guess you'd say. And there's a little bit more about him in the news. We'll talk about that. Also discuss Obama's race speech and give a reply from the white community if such a thing existed other than in the virtual world. Whites having been denied an identity by Jews and having refused to take up their own part for lo these many years. So first though, we're going to hear two more songs, and then we're going to hear our opening song. So that'll make three songs total. Here we go. Heard Oingo Boingo Stay. This is going to be Queen Killer Queen, and then we're going to hear Oingo Boingo Private Life, and then our opening song. Here we go.
She keeps a Moët Chandon in a pretty cabinet. Let them eat cakes, she says, just like Marie Antoinette. A building remedy for Khrushchev and Kennedy. At a time of invitation, you can't decline. Caviar and cigarettes, well versed in etiquette, extraordinarily nice. She's a killer queen, gunpowder, gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam. To blow your mind. Ooh, recommended at the price, insatiable and appetite. Wanna try? To avoid complications, she never kept the same address. In conversation, she spoke just like a baroness. Middleman from China, but down to Geisha Minor. Because she couldn't care less, fastidious and precise. She's a killer queen, gunpowder, gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind. Momentarily out of action, temporarily out of action. So absolutely dry. She's out to get you. She's a killer queen, gunpowder, gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind. Anytime. Recommended at the price, insatiable and appetite. Wanna try?
Get me out of here.
About 3:15 a.m. on April 2nd, year of our Lord, 2008. I'd like to welcome you to Radio Astina. I'm the host, Alex Linder. Feeling quite alert. Ready to go here. Fell asleep there for a couple hours, hence the delay of the show. What do we got here? Let me check our sound levels. Looks like we're doing okay on that end. We get a little bit used to that. I'm going to raise it up just a little bit here so that you can hear me without too much of an effort. I don't know how long we're going to go today, but we're going to cover a couple of different things. As always, I encourage people to send mail. You can send it to P.O. Box 101, Kirksville, Missouri. K-I-R-K-S-V-I-L-L-E, Missouri, 63501. That'll go to my attention. Something I have here. Now, before I get into this related to Social Security and Administration and its overt discrimination by race against our race, let's see what's going on generally. Before I got on, I did a little bit of research. We always like to follow up in stories we've covered on earlier Radio Astinas, and this is Radio Astina number 17. Beginning last year, we did about 8 or 9 shows, and we've already done 6 or 7 this year. And this being the 17th, one thing we track is homeschooling, and as you recall, the big uproar lately has been over a judge's ruling in the Second Appeals Court down in Southern California, and pertaining only to that area, that you had to have a teaching certificate to homeschool your kid, and this has caused a national uproar, really. But the upshot right now is that after the remarks by Governor Schwarzenegger and the remarks, the quick resistance by the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, led by Mike Ferris, the result is that they're going to hold, in June, I just found today, they're going to hold they're going to re-examine that decision. I don't know, there's some process they have by doing that, and he said he thought they'd already vacated it, but he didn't know what the ultimate upshot would be. I guess vacated the opinion means they're going to, just kidding. Even though what we said had legal force, we were just kind of kidding. Because Schwarzenegger had threatened to overturn it. Another thing I saw in Nebraska, where the NEA made a brief feint to do the same kind of impose the same kind of restrictions that would essentially forbid homeschooling, resulting in 1,300 homeschoolers and their families showing up at the Nebraska legislature. The government formally issued a proclamation praising homeschoolers for producing, you know, such fine results. So the homeschoolers are winning because they're attacking, and these are almost all homeschoolers are white, almost all are Christian, almost all come from big families, and almost all make their own way in the world, not needing the government, which sets a terrible precedent for a government that lectures and hectors us in every possible way. And if you ever watch any TV or listen to any radio, you know that these public service announcements, these PSAs, as they call them, are well nigh unavoidable. They're ubiquitous. And this is very much a communist thing. The state replaces religion and every intermediary institution and fills the role of parents, church, you know, even Little League, and for Christ's sakes, in the lives of the young. I mean, they're literally on there telling people to go outside and play. Everything from that on up. And this is just the all concentrated power in the state, and the people are reduced to basically robots who are supposed to carry out pre-implanted orders, and that's not how you want it. That's why I say the devolution of political power is a white idea. Having a one big man in the middle of things running everything is very much a black idea. And on that front, we turn to Zimbabwe just briefly to update that as well. They've had an election there on the 29th of March, and we've often discussed the history of Zimbabwe and the misery brought on that country simultaneous with black rule. Well, it's gotten worse and worse since blacks took over in 1980, and so bad that inflation was 100,000% in January of 2008. And it appears that Mugabe, basically under these circumstances where 4 million of the country's 12 million people are more or less fled the country because they don't want to starve to death, Mugabe lost the election, and he's deciding right now whether or not he's going to allow the results to be revealed and step down from power. And he's 84, but apparently in good health, and I think his people are probably split to some extent over whether he ought to hang on. They've already pretty much ripped off whatever there is to rip off in the country. So that is where that stands right now. The only thing to say on that front is that while Washington and every other Western liberal democracy pretends that it's a matter of who's elected, the deeper flaw is that you have blacks pretending to rule themselves. Well, not pretend, they actually are ruling themselves, but they're not fit for it. So, of course, it doesn't matter who replaces Mugabe. He might be, you know, 10% better or 10% worse. It's still going to be incompetently and corruptly run. Corruption is the rule wherever blacks hold power. I mean, another example we discussed on the recent released Goyfire 55. In fact, it was released on April 1st. Is Kwame Kilpatrick in Detroit. And I read a fairly sober, if biased, write-up on the World Socialist website, and it went into some of the past shenanigans. Well, this is a young black mayor. He's a big fat nigger. He's got a diamond stud in his ear, and when his wife's away, the strippers come over, and, well, the wife came back early about 5 years ago and caught the stripper and got in a fight with her, and a few days later she was murdered. And her kids are suing to reveal text messages passed back and forth between cops because there were a couple of strippers killed. It wasn't just one, and apparently they were killed by off-duty policemen. Or it looks like it might be that way. Well, that was a 2002 or 3 problem. Well, now he's got the new problem is he was using the police to cover up his different affairs, and this was revealed by the Detroit Free Press. And basically Kwame Kilpatrick's administration, in a time of bankruptcy, very much like Robert Mugabe over in Africa, since it's race, not place, that matters, paid off 3 officers whose careers and lives he destroyed to the tune of about $8 million. And this is when his city is utterly bankrupt and has already had to fire thousands of people and is very close to receivership. So this is the rule wherever blacks run things. And this is why whites need to run themselves, and they have an interest in having a whites-only country. And now we'll turn to a letter I got from a listener, or at least a reader of VNN. His name is Frank Kelleher, and he used to work for the Social Security Administration. He wasn't a big decision maker. He was a comparatively low-level fellow, I believe, not knowing fully all these different government designations, but I believe he was a clerk typist of some sort. But I'm going to read his letter to me and what he says, and it's accompanied by an article from the Washington Times. That's the Mooney-owned right-wing neoconservative newspaper in Washington, D.C. that was getting going when I was out there a decade ago. Or I should say now, it's 20 years ago almost, back in 88, 89, in the early 90s. And also, he's also included 3 pages from what appears to be some sort of judges or somebody's summation of some of the proceedings in the case he filed against the Social Security Administration, his employer. Let's talk about that, and when we're done talking about that, we'll take a brief music break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about Obama. But this is a good example of how the government officially discriminates against whites, is what this amounts to, and how it's pretty brazen about it, and even under legal pressure, it really doesn't do that much. And I've said before, you've heard me say before, that William Pierce, the ordinary way that anything political or educational is set up is as a 501c3 educational foundation. And that has certain restrictions in return for allowing you to accept donated money and allow the donors to write off the taxes. You can't endorse the candidates or parties. You can be as biased and partisan as you want, but you can't endorse candidates or parties. And so that would be the natural form that something that was designed to protect white interests, say, by growing media or spreading. If it wasn't going to be a private media company, if it was going to be something more or less akin to a church, that's the legal form that it would take. William Pierce tried to set up the Cosmotheist Church as such an entity, and he was explicitly refused under a decision. I don't remember who made the decision or where it was, but I know what it means, and what the important thing is for you to understand is that whites are not afforded the same legal protections as non-whites and Jews. So it's an old plaint of the left that, oh, blacks were second-class citizens in 1950s America. Well, they don't tell you. Whites are second-class citizens today. So they don't have a problem with someone being a second-class citizen. They have a problem with whites being first-class citizens. They have a problem with whites controlling their own destiny, whether it's their personal destiny here with their employer or whether it's their group social identity as a nation that wants to control its own borders and not start wars every 10 seconds. All right, this fellow's name again is Frank Kelleher. I gather he used to work in D.C. and he's subsequently moved outside of it. But he writes, he says, this is dated March 10th, 2008, so within the last month. Dear Mr. Linder, enclosed is written proof, as if you needed any, that the U.S. government discriminates against white men and has made us second-class citizens. These two items speak for themselves. If you have questions, please call, and it gives me a number and an email address. And we can't do that right now, but at some point we'll get to where we can interview these people online. And I think Radio Whiteland is going to start up earlier or later today on the 2nd. So I know that they're going to be fully equipped to be able to do interviews. So this is the type of thing that would be good if we have hosts who want to discuss these things with people on air. It's not just me who can do it. It's all of the different people associated with VNN. So he says, Kelleher goes on, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution provides, quote, equal protection of the law, unquote, for all citizens of the U.S., not just protected groups. And that's a very specific, meaningful phrase, protected groups. It's a legal phrase. Actually, it's a legal term, not a phrase. There's no verb in it. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, he says, outlaws, quote, unquote, racial discrimination. And yet they do it anyway, against white men. The enclosed status conference summary on pages 2 and 3 says only members of, quote, unquote, protected groups can defend themselves against racial discrimination. This is a little, subterfuge they use to maintain at the media level the idea that the act means what it says, that there's no legal discrimination, but in fact only members of protected groups can claim that they're being discriminated against. So whites don't even have the grounds to file these suits. The newspaper article, that's the Washington Times article, defines blacks and Hispanics as protected but not white men. What happened to the constitutional right of equal protection under the law? What happened to all the government workers who took an oath of office to uphold the laws and Constitution of the United States? Sincerely, Frank Kelleher. Well, what happened was there was a Judeo-communist takeover in the mid-60s when all this type of law was passed. And what it did was precisely what he says. It reduced white men to second, or I would say third-class citizens. They're behind Jews. The other groups are protected groups. And whites are open to predation groups. Now let's read a little from the Washington Times article, and then we'll look at the formal government statement itself. This article by Ruth Larson, SSA staffer cites discrimination against whites, and this is from a paper, Washington Times, December 27th, 1996, so 12 years ago already, more than 12 years ago. The Social Security Administration worker has accused the agency of reverse discrimination. Again, why did the Jews use the term reverse discrimination? It's just discrimination. This implies that discrimination against blacks is normal. No, what was normal was free association, allowing people to discriminate, which is to think, to generalize, and to act upon their thinking the way they saw fit. So the term should be discrimination, not reverse discrimination. He's accused the agency of reverse discrimination because he has been prohibited from organizing a white affairs advisory council to mirror a black council afforded special rights. So he's trying to set up a group to protect whites, look after the interests of whites the same way that blacks and mestizos and feminists and Jews have special groups. This is not affirmative action, said Frank T. Kelleher, who says he is being denied an opportunity to be represented by an officially sanctioned employee advocacy group simply because he is white. This is outright, flagrant, blatant racial discrimination. It favors one race over another and grants benefits to one race that are denied to another simply because of race, said the 60-year-old clerk typist with the agency's Office of Hearings and Appeals. The Black Affairs Advisory Council, created in the early 1980s, gets to meet directly with the agency's director, Commissioner Shirley S. Chater, or Chater, C-H-A-T-E-R, four times a year to talk about issues that concern group members. But because there is no officially recognized white council, Mr. Kelleher feels no one represents whites in the agency. Again, this is a technique, and we see it here used even in a right-wing paper. Always when whites cite something objective, the leftist paper reporter puts it down as the white feels or whites believed, even when it's so visceral as being attacked and beaten up by a group of niggers. They'll say, well, he believed he had was being attacked, you know, stuff like that ridiculous. They're trying to deny what... And this is the sort of thing when it happens to leftists or minorities or Jews. Oh, we're trying to deny the reality of their experience. We're trying to silence their voices. Well, this is a way that you silence someone's voice. Again, what they accuse us of doing is what they are actually doing. The way that you silence someone's voice is pretending, oh, it really isn't happening, or we're not going to do anything about it. Like when white kids are beaten up in public schools, it takes an outsider like a Yankee Jim to step in there and stand up for the white kid who's being abused. The administration won't do it. Well, here we have in Washington, D.C., where all power is centralized, we have the Social Security just refusing to grant whites the same rights, not privileges, rights that it grants to other groups by law. So what the blacks and the Mexicans and the other groups that are officially recognized have is the right to meet with the administration of this agency 4 times a year and go over their grievances or what they want done. But whites have no similar standing. Social Security spokesman Philip A. Gambino said Mr. Keller's complaints are groundless. We made it more than clear to employees who've asked if they could form a white affairs group that we would provide space, email, and equipment. It's perfectly okay. Mr. Gambino said, the agency ruled in 1998 that unofficial groups may not meet during work hours, meet with visiting officials, use agency facilities for meetings or publicized gatherings in agency publications. Mr. Gambino says that is no longer the case. What we won't do is afford them the rights given to groups considered to be, and here he's using a legal phrase, protected groups under EEO, equal employment opportunities. So, as always, the left proceeds in one direction. It goes west and says it's going east. So you have law that supposedly makes everyone equal. Equal employment opportunities is the law, but the reality is that people are divided into protected groups and unprotected groups, predators and prey. And if you fall into the wrong group, then you have no standing to have any official group identity or any whites that can be argued for, advocated for, or protected. No rights that the agency need respect. I mean, where else would you find a government spokesman, and obviously a white one named Gambino, saying that what we won't do is afford whites rights? He doesn't say whites. What we won't do is afford them the rights given to other groups. So you have the spokesman overtly saying, we will not give white people the same rights that we give to these so-called protected groups. They are of a different legal class than the whites who set up the country. What we won't do is afford them the rights given to groups considered to be protected groups under EEO, such as allowing groups representing blacks, Hispanics, the disabled, and women to meet quarterly with a commissioner, he said. Mr. Gambino pointed out that a men's group was recently formed at the agency, but it is not permitted to meet with Mrs. Chatter either. There's no case for saying that there's been any pattern of discrimination against men, he said, noting that while men make up about a third of the workforce, they fill about two-thirds of management positions. In a letter, Mr. Chatter, so basically what they're doing is, since whites formed and founded everything that exists in this country, they're using that as a basis to discriminate against younger whites. So they leave the old ones and they get rid of them as quickly as they can, and they discriminate. They don't let new whites in the door. And you see this in institution after institution, whether it's the Social Security, you know, clerk typist pool, or whether it's all the way up to medical school and legal school. They discriminate against non-Jewish whites, non-Hispanic whites. And they're very blatant about it. They're going to force you to bear the burden of what they say is an ugly, sinful past. That's the underlying ideology here. The practical result is whites are denied opportunities, and the whites are qualified for these opportunities, whereas the blacks, women, etc., etc., not women, but blacks, Mexicans, disabled, are not qualified for these jobs, other than by virtue of their membership in the specific class that's being protected. This is the country as it has been unmade and redone, redecorated under the Jews. The important thing here is that America today has nothing to offer whites. it discriminates them at every step of the way. And that's why we call, unlike the conservatives, we don't call for reform. We call for a revolution. We have no interest in any political affiliation whatsoever with blacks, Mexicans, or Jews. They need us to feed off of us, to live off of our creation of the technology and the conditions for life and our tax money. We don't need them. They drag us down while trying to drag themselves up by our bootstraps. Our goal at this time is to build a workforce at SSA that reflects the diverse society that we serve, and in doing so, we will continue to consider the needs and aspirations of all employees, Mrs. Chotter wrote. Mr. Kelleher first asked permission to establish an officially sanctioned advisory group for whites in 1988. Social Security officials denied his request in December 1988, citing the agency's efforts to address workforce diversity through its affirmative employment program. We believe the plan will be an effective mechanism by which we can identify and correct manifest imbalances or conspicuous, that's not a word, but that's the word that this federal employee wrote, this diversity ideologue. Correct manifest imbalance or conspicuous, she meant conspicuous, absence of any targeted group. Therefore, we see no need to establish another advisory group to represent targeted employees, wrote Joan F.M. Stewart, director of the agency's Office of Civil Rights and Equal Opportunity. So there you have someone who's directing an Office of Equal Opportunity who's manifestly not interested in legal equality at all. And the reason they are not interested in legal equality, which is merely the cover story that they use to sell to whites, they sell non-discrimination to whites. The reality is you go from whites running civilized white society and letting blacks whatever do what they can to a society in which whites are overtly discriminated against in the name of equality. First whites are up, then blacks are up, and you're supposed to like it and think that that's good. And it's not just in America, it's everywhere that Jews hold power. In black South Africa, where 11 out of 12 people are black, and the whites turned over at the behest of the international Jewish global media, turned over power to the blacks, affirmative action is even stronger than in America. Whites have a hard time getting any kind of job whatsoever, even though the blacks are almost uniformly, completely unqualified. Not a problem. The key to the Jews is destroying the white race because it poses a competitive threat to the Jews in terms of political control. And it's not just in the government, it's in the private media. They don't want any whites free to speak to other whites, and if they can, they will suppress it. We had an example earlier today at the PaleoCon magazine called Taki Mag. And Taki is a Greek billionaire. He runs a paleoconservative online site. And I and a few others from the white nationalist community have been posting on there, making the same fact-filled, substantial post about Jews that we make at viennainforum.com. And this so disturbed them that after 2 days of this, it went beyond their simply deleting the various comments we'd made to, we need to reorganize this site completely to prevent any kind of criticism of Jews from getting out there. This was the post by Paul Gottfried, who is a Jew who was allowed to circulate by the disloyal right, by the kosherite white nationalists at Amren and Taki magazine and Chronicles. They treat him as one of their own, but in fact, he's just another Jew claiming that his people escaped, they fled Nazi terror, i.e. they emigrated from Germany, when it became difficult to carry on their swindles in the accustomed manner. Everywhere we go, across the media and government, we see whites discriminated against, and only our uniting on the basis of our race can change things. Mr. Kelleher said that since his first request was rejected, he has periodically attempted to raise the issue with superiors without success. In October, for instance, Mr. Kelleher tried to bring up the issue at a town hall meeting for Social Security employees. The question he submitted was, why should my boss, who makes several times my salary, have an officially recognized organization to represent him simply because of his race, while I am denied the same benefit for the same reason? Social Security officials refused to respond to his question, Mr. Kelleher said. So what you've no doubt got there is a black or other member of a protected group appointed politically at a multiple of the honest, hardworking white man's salary. And the white man is not allowed to organize to protect his own interests, according to the judges set up by the rulers of the country. What interest do we have in the continuation of this illegal, anti-white, Jew-friendly, world-damaging regime that exists in Washington, D.C.? We have no interest in it continuing whatsoever. It preys on us. Let's look at the overt publication here. This is a status conference summary in the case of Frank T. Kelleher, the appellant, versus the Social Security Administration. The paper I have is dated November 16th, 2004. These things drag on for years. I'll just read a little of what I presume this is a judge. I can't tell what it is, but it's some kind of administrative figure who's resolving complaints against Social Security Administration. He says, during the teleconference between Kelleher and Kia Finney, who's representing the agency, I reviewed the appeal, detailed the contents of the board's record to ensure it was complete, specifically discussed the agency's burden of proof. The agency must prove by a preponderance of evidence the merits of its charge that the appellant was disrespectful and discourteous. The agency must also prove its action removing the appellant promoted the efficiency of the service and did not exceed the bounds of reasonableness under the circumstances of this case. The appellant was advised that any defenses raised in his pre-hearing submission will have to be proven by preponderant evidence. In addition, he will be required to support any such claimed defenses by factual arguments in his submission. Now we get to the main part. The appellant confirmed during the teleconference that he intended to raise the affirmative defenses of race and sex discrimination. He's going to argue that he's discriminated against because of his race and sex, and whistleblowing retaliation, that is letting other people know that there's a problem going on here. Accordingly, the following information must be included in the appellant's pre-hearing submission. Race and sex discrimination. There are two theories of discrimination: disparate treatment, which is the most common claim of discrimination, and disparate impact. The appellant must identify whether he's alleging disparate treatment, disparate impact, or both, as do his claims of race and sex discrimination. A. Disparate treatment. The elements of a claim of discrimination on the ground of disparate treatment are: A. That the appellant is a member of a protected group. B. That he was similarly situated to an individual who is not a member of a protected group. And C. That he was treated more harshly or disparately than the individual who was not a member of his protected group. Once the appellant has established a prima facie case, the burden shifts to the agency to articulate a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for the agency's action. So, the interesting part here is that the element of a claim of discrimination is that only this is about a doubly compounded irony. The only people who can file claiming they've been discriminated against are those who are members of a protected group, i.e. those who are discriminated in favor of. If you're officially, legally, by law, discriminated against, that is the basis for not being allowed to file a suit. You get that? And all this is proceeding under the, oh, we have equal protection of the law. There won't be any racial discrimination. Well, actually, yeah, there will be. There will be racial discrimination. But we're going to play lawyer ball and get around that by saying that only we're going to define certain protected classes. And so that way we're not discriminating by race. We're just going to say, well, only protected classes, only members of protected classes have a basis for claiming they're discriminated against. Think about that. So not only are they protected legally and officially and given preference and privilege over whites, the colors are the only ones who can file to claim they're discriminated against. I mean, he very clearly, and not in so many words, is saying you can't even file this because The elements of a claim of discrimination are that the appellant is a member of a protected group. Well, Frank T. Kelleher, who could be you or me, is not a member of a protected group. He's a male and not a female, and he's a white and not a black, Mexican, or other. So he has no basis for filing. Yet he is discriminated against by law. I mean, this is how things operate under Jewish communism, American style. You understand that? This is communism. There's an elevated class and there's an oppressed majority. The elevated class is the Jews and the tools they use to destroy us, who are the second class, and we are the third class. And I think that that really pretty much sums up what we have to say here. Perhaps at some point we'll discuss this with Frank himself and see how it turned out. But I believe that what happened was he was fairly old when this started. He was already in his 60s, and I think he chose to retire. I think they fired him or were going to get rid of him, and he chose to retire. So he's got to be now in his early 70s. So this is how our federal government has treated kind of the legacy of white employees. And I remember a phrase that a sociologist professor I knew in California at one point, Fred Lynch, author of White Males, Fred Lynch is the author of a book called Invisible Victims, White Males and the Crisis of Affirmative Action. Fred Lynch is one of the few non-Stalinist sociologists out there. He's written other books about diversity. He's basically a pretty good guy. He spent a lot of time talking to me and taught me a lot of stuff, more than I learned at Pomona from the left-wing professors out there in just, you know, about 8 or 9 hours of interviewing for an article I never wrote about 20 years ago. But he was the first to academically really study the white males and their reaction to affirmative action, and he covered a lot of cases like this. And I lost my point there, my train of thought, other than to say that the laws that whites suffer on now were set up in the mid-60s to the early 70s, and actually Richard Nixon played a large role in institutionalizing affirmative action as put in place legally by Lyndon Johnson. And the upshot is, that's what it was. The phrase that I don't know if Frederick Lynch invented the phrase, but the Browning of public service. And that's what Kelleher's case reflects, is basically they adopt a almost exclusively brown, black, and female hiring policy day forward from their instituting affirmative action, and that results in basically they don't hire young white males. And, you know, as they drive private industry offshore, I mean, government is one of the few jobs that has a lot of benefits. Well, the benefits are all going to the blacks and the browns, not the whites. And then the whites who are left there that they can't really fire, because you can never really fire someone who works for government, they just mistreat them and treat them as third-class citizens and try to get them out the door as soon as possible. This is what goes on in a Jewish communist state that we have in America. So that's the story of Frank T. Kelleher. As I said, perhaps we'll speak to him at some point. Let's take a little music break now. We come back, we'll talk a little more about Obama and his race speech that everybody seemed to think was such a great thing. Now, I found a little tool to record sound, and I recorded some music that I like. We played Oingo Boingo earlier. Even Danny Elfman actually is a Jew. He's the singer of Oingo Boingo, but I like their songs to some extent. I don't try to be too doctrinaire on music. You won't hear any hip-hop, though. I hate that crap. Now, you won't hear any jazz or blues either. I can't stand that stuff. What do we have here? Let me see. We're going to play let's see. We're going to play about 3 songs, and then we'll come back, I think. Let's start with let's hear maybe a Deer Tick. We're going to play a Deer Tick, we're going to play an Everclear, and then we're going to play an Alphaville, actually. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but we're going to play that. So here we go.
I don't wanna be swept by hate or lust.
Okay, we're back. What we heard there was Art Isn't Real by Deer Tick, a guy named John McCauley, I believe. He's the principal. And then we heard Hater, a song by Everclear. And we heard from Alphaville there at the last, To Germany with Love. That's kind of, they are classified as a new wave group back from the 80s. Now we're going to go ahead and give the white community's response to Obama's speech on race. This segment, and we'll examine the lies, the myths, the misconceptions, and the motives behind them. And this supposedly stirring speech. I have not watched it. I don't care a damn to watch it. I know what Obama is, and what he is is not what he is. It's what he represents. He's an attempt to give the people the closest thing they can to a functioning noble Negro, as portrayed in 1,000 Stephen King movies and on every TV show put on TV since roughly 1960. The imaginary black who's civilized, intelligent, urbane, and an example of why the founders of the country were wrong not even to consider granting blacks any kind of political rights, since they're obviously incapable of them, of exercising them appropriately. Now let's go through it a little bit and read it and talk about it. Let's see, what do we have here? Okay, we have... the name of his speech is A More Perfect Union, which is an unfortunate combination of words. Of course, they didn't come from him. But you're either perfect or you're imperfect. You can't be more perfect or less perfect. There are other words to discuss degrees of improvement than perfect. Perfect is not one of them. So that was a kind of a malaprop by one of our founders. And what we have here from Obama is essentially the restatement of the progressive myth. America is this noble unfolding of an unrealized promise. And we will show through this discussion that that's utterly false. And in fact is bringing misery and degradation on the group of people that is alone fit to exercise political power. It certainly is not blacks. They have shown themselves incapable of exercising effective political power, whether in Detroit, as we already discussed, or in Zimbabwe. And certainly Barack Obama would be no better. And let's see. He says, the document they produced was eventually signed, but ultimately unfinished. It was sustained by this nation's original sin of slavery, right? And so what they do there is they try to enlist the biblical morality, the biblical concept of original sin, in support of their progressive, for which you may read, anti-white agenda, while claiming they're fulfilling the purpose of a document written by the very white racist type that they specifically despise, and as we saw in the case of Kelleher, actively discriminate against. So lying is second nature to progressives of the Obama ilk and the Jews who are behind them and who are running them as their horses and their dogs in this fight. Of course, he says, the answer to the slavery question was already embedded within our Constitution, a Constitution that had at its very core the ideal of equal citizenship under the law. Okay, it did not have that as its ideal. And if it had had that as its ideal, it would have written it in its language. Things that are not unequal cannot be made equal by law. Over time, as classes prove themselves capable of exercising certain political rights, then it might make sense to grant them those rights, or to affirm those rights, and so change things slowly and carefully. But in an age in which people have been dumbed down for decades through the public schools and through bogus pronouncements from pulpit and president, any restriction on rights seems unfair and invidious, because we all know that one opinion is as good as another. Facts don't exist. There's just your opinion and my opinion. And as the Judeo-Marxists have taught, every opinion is just a cover story for interests. It's a cover story for power relations between groups. So you're presenting to the other guy. What the Jews do there is they project on others what they actually do themselves. They say they want universal brotherhood. What they mean is they want one system for Israel and another system for everybody else. What they do themselves, more than any other group, they project onto everybody else. The Constitution means more or less what it says. And it's not hard to understand what it means. And when they grant only, they say only people over 35 can vote for president. Well, that's discrimination. They say only, you know, free white males over 21 who own property can vote at all. Well, that's discrimination. Now, why would they discriminate against that, like that? Because they knew that only these classes, as defined by them, doing the best they could, contain enough members who act responsibly to make it worthwhile to give them some political power to confirm it. They knew that if they allowed people without any property, without any brains, you know, who were just fly-by-nighters, they knew it would destroy the country. Because all those people would do would be like thieves. They would vote to steal goods from those who had them, and those who had them and earned them had developed them. Well, lo and behold, that's exactly what we have today. The brown classes vote to steal money from the white classes that earned it, that developed things. And the schools, the government schools, are used to teach lies about the origins of whatever wealth we have in America. So it's denied that whites developed a totally undeveloped continent. Instead, the blacks who are now allowed to vote are told that the country was developed on their backs and at their expense and using their brains. Well, none of that is true. So it's lies straight across the board that we get from Obama and his progressive ilk, which is ultimately a bunch of Jewish Marxists creating these ideas and choosing the carriers of these ideas for public consumption. They're the ones putting the Clintons and the Obamas out front. Slavery was not an original sin. It was a mistake. It was a mistake to bring over blacks to this country because of white, what might happen. They can't mix with whites. Of course, the Jews who brought the blacks over here did so never caring that it might disrupt the future of the country. What they did was try to make money off the blacks. Of course, today they very carefully conceal that most of the slave ships were owned by Jews, and Jews dominated the slave trade in the Americas and the West Indies. Dominated it, according to their own historians. And you can find more about that at blacksandjews.com, where Farrakhan's researchers have gone back through the Jewish historians' records, and they found the Jews saying in so many words exactly what I just said, that Jews dominated the slave trade. Didn't see any of that in Roots. It's not a Jewish slave ship owner in Amistad. It's only evil white males who were discriminated against by law, as we've seen earlier in the show. So, and yet words on parchment would not be enough to deliver slaves from bondage or provide men and women of every color and creed their full rights and obligations as citizens of the United States. Blah, blah, blah. Great struggles. They're struggling. Always these great struggles to liberate them. What do they do when they're liberated? Well, like Kwame Kilpatrick, they bankrupt their city, and they have strippers over, and they have orgies when their wife's away. That's what blacks do. Or like Zimbabwe and Robert Mugabe, who's Western-raised and educated in all the fine white institutions by the fine white Catholic morals. What does he do? Well, he starves his people. He steals all the farms from the whites who know how to farm, gives them to blacks who don't, and then sits back and enjoys, you know, $25 million birthday parties while his people are starving. That's what blacks do. So if you liberate them, that's what you're going to get. So you can't separate the process from the result. But that's what liberals always do. Oh, we have to worship democracy. Why do we have to worship it? What's so great about it? Look at the results that it brings. They don't even believe in their own words, though, because if you elect someone that they don't like, say Hamas in Palestine, why, then they just simply throw the result out and clamor for a revote. And, you know, we get the blah, blah, blah. We want a better future for our children and our grandchildren. And as always, these, you know, he's running the standard Clinton line, you know, we have to choose between hope and fear, and he, you know, audacity of hope. And of course, the way that Democrats operate, and I've seen Carville do this face to face almost. I saw him give a keynote address at a healthcare conference I was covering, and it's, there's the good people who want change, and there's the bad old people who resist change. And it's very, very ominous, very frightening facial gestures, that old snakehead, as they call him, he gives. And you're to understand that he and his good progressive force are going to bring in the desirable change and get rid of the bad old ways and the bad old institutions. Of course, this is never defined. They never say precisely what they're going to do. It's always kept at the level of abstraction. And there's a reason for that. Once you start talking specifics, you alienate potential voters. By staying with abstractions, you encourage the listener to map his own concerns onto your, into your general categories. And if you're particularly good at this, you can talk to two people on different sides of the same issue and walk away from them with both of them believing that you're on their side. Clinton could do that. He was a good enough Democratic politician. Small d. And Obama is following a proven pattern for success when he sticks to these careful abstractions and never departs from them. Throughout the first year of this campaign, against all predictions of the contrary, we saw how hungry the American people were for this message of unity. Despite the temptation to view my candidacy through a purely racial lens, we won commanding victories in states with some of the whitest populations in the country. South Carolina, where the Confederate flag still flies, we built a powerful coalition of African Americans and white Americans. Well, these states have large black minorities, or the black belt goes across the South. The blacks are all going to vote for Obama because he's black, and the whites are basically all going to vote for a white candidate, or at least a large number of them will. Not as large as the blacks. The blacks are always going to vote over 90% for a black candidate, whereas the whites are going to vote probably 70% for the white candidate if it comes down to it. And you know what do we have to unite over? There's nothing to unite over. His message is, vote for me and I will steal from the whites and give to you, as we'll see later on in the speech. And, you know, he's portraying himself as in the moderate, the golden mean between the extremes of his own pastor, for Christ's sakes. And he's thrown, he'll show, throw anybody under the bus, his own grandmother or his pastor. Although he didn't really separate from his pastor. He threw his grandmother under the bus, but not his pastor. And, you know, you're great and you're good if you believe that whites and blacks can mix together. But, of course, this pretense that we can all be united, regardless of race, can only be sustained by leaving the facts out of the equation. So that Obama will never tell you that there are 36 to 40,000 whites being raped each year. Those are the reported rapes by blacks. He can't tell you that. That would bring disunity. He can't tell you that 85% of the time when whites move, they move to a whiter area than the one they're leaving. That shows what people really think, and the fact that there aren't any whites standing up and defending those people and advocating their interest shows you just how strong the control of this system is. The control of the media and the government working in tandem to prevent the rise of any white identity politics. Whereas black identity politics is just fine, and this speech was celebrated across the spectrum for being marvelous rhetoric and really something new in race relations and something new in presidential politics. It's none of those things. And he talks about Reverend Wright, and you're familiar with all that, and how he won't cut himself off from Reverend Wright. Always what the Jews do, the minute someone makes a statement that they don't like, they demand that other members of that same class or race repudiate him. Except, of course, when it comes to Barack Obama and his anti-white pastor. And a lot of what the pastor said made sense. The part against whites didn't make any sense. It was belied by his own behavior in moving to a $1 million home in a white, almost exclusively white area. He says, as imperfect as Wright may have been, he has been like family to me. He strengthened my faith, officiated my wedding, and baptized my children. Not once in my conversations with him have I heard him talk about any ethnic group in derogatory terms or treat whites with whom he interacted with anything but courtesy and respect. isn't that belied by the very video clips that have gone around the nation? He contains within him the contradictions, the good and the bad of the community that he has served diligently for so many years. So I can no more disown him than I can disown the black community. Okay, what are you if you say there's a white community? You're a hater. You're called a hater by the same people praising Obama. I can no more disown him than I can my white grandmother, a woman who helped raise me, a woman who sacrificed again and again for me, a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of black men who passed by her on the street and who, on more than one occasion, has uttered racial or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe. So there you go. He's denouncing his own grandmother for being a racist, but not his pastor. The fact is, the comments that have been made and the issues that have surfaced over the last few weeks reflect the complexities of race in this country that we've never really worked through, a part of our union that we have yet to perfect. And we walk away now, if we simply retreat into our respective corners, we will never be able to come together and solve challenges like healthcare or education or the need to find good jobs for every American. These are not things that any black nation has solved ever. And there is nothing the white race could do that would be more injurious to its prospects, to its very future, to its very existence, than tying its future to the blacks. All blacks want, they're like a drowning man who wants to hold on to us to preserve a few more years of life. They can't sustain themselves. Most blacks only exist because of white medicine and white technology. White know-how created most blacks, but if you think that they appreciate that, they don't. Neither intellectually nor morally do they appreciate that. Instead, slavery is our original sin, for which we are to pay forever and ever. Original sin, and religiously, never goes away. Well, if they're calling slavery an original sin, then it will never go away. It will be something they will beat us over the head with until there aren't any of us left. And they'll beat our memory over the head with it when we're gone. So we have no way to escape them but to separate from them physically and politically. And that's the goal. Building that revolution, separating from blacks physically and politically, is what we're all about here at VNN and Radio Astina. He says, we do need to remind ourselves that so many of the disparities that exist in the African-American community can be directly traced to inequalities passed on from an earlier generation that suffered under the brutal legacy of slavery and Jim Crow. This is doctrinaire liberalism. It's utterly a lie. In fact, by every statistical measure, blacks were doing better under Jim Crow than they are today under civil rights. And if you don't believe that, go read Thomas Sowell, a black academic. He's kind of a crazy neocon on foreign policy, but he's reliable on affirmative action and the history of blacks in America, by and large, apart from his claiming that blacks are violent because they learned it from southern rednecks. And what he shows is that blacks they had lower rates of bastardy, which are now about 80%. They used to be under like a 25% where the white rate is now. They were married, they had families when they were discriminated against. They were more violent still, they were stupider still than whites, but they were more civilized because whites more or less wouldn't allow them to be, in our presence, uncivilized. All that changed when the Jews took over the country in the 60s and loosed them and freed their natural impulses. The talented 10% went off and mixed with whites and got rich under affirmative action. The other 90% went to hell. And just bred and bred and bred until there are 35 million blacks. I mean, number one thing to observe here is that only a few hundred thousand blacks were ever brought to America in ships. And yet today there are over 35 million blacks in America. So America hasn't been too bad to blacks. Their population numbers have shot up tremendously, given access to white human civilization, let us say, for it is only convention that bids us consider blacks as members of the same species. In reality, they are not. But of course, they ignore the facts about the forming of the Constitution and what the founders intended. It literally never crossed their mind to consider making blacks political equals to whites. They knew that blacks were savages. They hated slavery, not because it had bad effects on blacks, but because it had bad effects on white communities. And they knew that these people would get away and serve as a bad example to others. So they lied about the founders, He's lied about black history and blamed white racism. Blaming whites is what blacks do. Every black politician blames whites for the situation in black America and the black community, which is perfectly legitimate to use that construction, the black community. Well, who represents the white community? Well, we here at Radio Estina do. Does anyone else even affect or purport to speak for the whites? Is anyone acknowledged as a white spokesman by the Jew-controlled media? Hell no. They're the kingmakers. They're the ones who decide which interests are valid and which are not valid. Who's a legitimate speaker and who isn't. Whose claims must be considered and whose claims can be ignored. And they say that the black community exists and has interest and is being denied the satisfaction of its interest by a legacy of white racism. Even when, as we pointed out, using facts and evidence, it is whites who are being discriminated against. When these same progressives who talk all these marvelous words about non-discrimination and unity have power. When they have power, they use it to discriminate against the whites they hate, while calling the whites haters and blaming white supposed racism for all the problems that blacks have. Utterly ridiculous. Segregated schools were and are inferior schools. We still haven't fixed them 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education. And the inferior education they provided then and now helps explain the pervasive achievement gap between today's black and white students. Again, this is utterly refuted by facts. The gap has always been there. It's natural. It's a 15 to 30 point IQ depending on how much white blood the black has in between blacks and whites. They simply are not capable of handling the same material as whites. School segregation has not a thing to do with any of it. And in fact, they've tried everything in the book, including going back to segregation, and none of it works. That's because blacks are not, they do not have the same intellectual capacity that whites do on average. That 85 IQ versus 100 IQ, each one of those points means something. But of course, wherever there's a gap that's to the disadvantage of the colored races, the explanation for the gap will be white racism, and white guilt will be the order of the day, and whites will be forced to make up this gap somehow. They'll bear the brunt of the political abuse and the funding the left always claims is a solution to curing it. It doesn't matter how many quarters you pour in a nigger's pocket, he's not going to become educated. They don't care about education because they don't have any capacity for it. If they couldn't run and jump, you wouldn't find them on the basketball court. Well, they can't read and think, so what do they have need of a school? And again, this stuff has been studied ad infinitum, but the left, as always, is driven by an essentially religious view of things. And the religious view, in contradistinction to the factual view, is that men are equal, that one race is equal to another, and that any observed difference between them, and it better not be observed very sharply or frequently or spoken of in very loud terms, any difference between them is the result of some easily corrected political or social evil rather than any natural differential incapacity. But the facts are otherwise. Liberalism is, you know, there's only two ways you can go, really. Either you're reality-oriented, in which you go to the right, or you're delusional, crazy, or utopian, or essentially you allow religious views, you allow your head to overcome reality, and you go to the left. Or you're a Jew, in which you manipulate among yourselves. You know, in the view of that queen, you know, sex is too good for the commoners. Well, the Jewish view is reality is too good for this stupid, dirty goyim. Reality is for how we deal with our enemies in Israel, but we forbid whites from using the real facts of the situation in America. We pretend that the facts are otherwise. We knowingly inculcate in their young false doctrines. That's what they say in the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. We knowingly school their young in doctrines we know to be false. And one of the deeper falsehoods that they inculcate is the idea that races are equal, but they're not really appearing to be equal in real life because of white racism. racism being a unique quality of whites that is whites are uniquely evil. They are dispensers of racism, and the racism is holding everybody else back, who are really equal according to their bogus political religion. So here we have, you know, all these blacks are being held back by this evil, but they're still struggling and overcoming because, gosh darn it, that's how blacks are. They struggle and overcome. You know, he doesn't see the letters that I do, or if he does, he doesn't care. I've seen, you know, people in white nationalism who were white victims of some of the first integrated schools. Why were the schools integrated? The people of Arkansas didn't want it. People of Little Rock didn't want to be forcibly integrated with jungle savages. Why did it happen? Well, because D.C. sent military men down there to shoot anyone who resisted. They didn't care about the white girls who were raped once these niggers were installed in their schools. They didn't care about the white boys who were beaten up. They didn't care about the lost learning opportunities for the white students because the blacks acted like monkeys, because they are monkeys. None of that ever makes the evening news. None of that is ever reflected in a real speech by a political candidate, because the people who hold those views are considered outside the pale of respectable discourse. The borders of the pale being set by the Jews who used to live in the pale in Russia. They determine what makes the news and what is hate. What is extremism? Well, the extremism is trying to force the races together when they're oil and water. They're radically different creatures and they belong apart. That's how they can best get along among their own kind. Just as the Jews like to be among their own kind in Israel, and they build walls around it. That's what whites want for themselves. Whites-only areas. White nations. Nation means common birth. That's why we're white nationalists. He says, but for all those who scratched and clawed their way to get a piece of the American dream, there were many who didn't make it. Those who were ultimately defeated in one way or another by discrimination. So see, he's saying that every black who didn't make it failed because of discrimination. That is, the cause was outside himself. It had nothing to do with his own character and efforts. It was discrimination. Who's responsible for discrimination? Well, the white man is. So all black failure, this is the liberal line, is attributable to white racism, white discrimination, a legacy of oppression, the legacy of Jim Crow, the legacy of slavery, go abroad, the legacy of apartheid. All black failure is due to white people. Whites are responsible for whatever happened to blacks. That is the liberal progressive line that is promoted by the Jews and the media they control. The media that is staffed solely by these liberal progressive self-hating whites and Jews. And Jews, believe me, are the top echelon. It's just like politics. Don't be fooled by the face on the screen. The face on the screen may be a liberal idiot goyim like Dan Rather, but the guy behind Dan Rather is a Sorensen or some other kike who's producing his stories and who's feeding him the memes. So he refers to over and over the anger that all these blacks have and how legitimate it is. And occasionally it finds voice in the church on Sunday morning, in the pulpit and the pews. The fact that so many people are surprised to hear that anger in some of Reverend Wright's sermons simply reminds us of the old truism that the most segregated hour in American life occurs on Sunday morning. That anger is not always productive. Indeed, all too often it distracts attention from solving real problems. It keeps us from squarely facing our own complicity in our condition and prevents the African American community from forging the alliances it needs to bring about real change. So he's making the faintest of nods at the William Cosby is saying that blacks are responsible for their own problems. But earlier he's disavowed all that by claiming that all blacks who have failed due ultimately to discrimination. He says, but the anger is real, it is powerful, and to simply wish it away, to condemn it without understanding its roots, only serves to widen the chasm of a misunderstanding that exists between the races. So blacks have this anger, and we need to understand their anger. Do we? No, we don't. They're angry because they're living among people who are much brighter and better looking than they are, and there's nothing that can really be done about it. And they're jealous and they want a part of it, but they don't have a legitimate way to acquire it. he says, most working and a similar anger exists within segments of the white community. Most working and middle-class white Americans don't feel they've been particularly privileged by race. Their experience is the immigrant experience. As far as they're concerned, no one's handed them anything. They've built it from scratch. Well, that's the fact. That's not as far as they're concerned. That's like the media portraying it as a matter of feeling or belief. They've worked hard all their lives, many times only to see their jobs shipped overseas or their pension dumped after a lifetime of labor. And then he talks about their fears of affirmative action. When they're told that their fears about crime in urban neighborhoods are somehow prejudiced, resentment builds over time. True. And what's notable about the speech is it's all very, very, very calibrated, very carefully calculated to appeal, but only just this far. And it's intended to make him look like he's reasonable, like he's moderate, like he's someone who is a little bit different and better from higher than other politicians. But we'll see that he's the same old thing, because his solution is the same old solution. Whites owe blacks. After all, we are responsible for the original sin of slavery. He gets into standard leftist boilerplate, blaming corporations and Washington insiders. Standard leftist stuff. Of course, he, just exactly like Hillary Clinton, has taken money from these same corporate fat cats that he denounces. They all are. Blah, blah, blah. Move beyond old racial wounds. Why do we need to move beyond old racial wounds? We don't need to live in the same country. Now, this was a figure I used in my Knoxville speech. I mean, you can get a divorce in 5 minutes in America. You know, you go down and file a no-fault divorce. But we can't get a racial divorce from blacks. Even when they're raping, you know, tens of thousands of whites each year, and they've murdered tens of thousands of whites since the Jewish communist takeover in the 1960s. We can't get a divorce from them. Why is that? Well, an invisible nose is forcing us together. The Jews are forcing us in with these blacks who are in no way like us and who actively hate us, in part because of their stupidity against our own, in part because they've been taught that we are responsible for all of their woes. And the Jews want to mix us in with these people until we basically no longer exist. Till we're totally wiggerized. And there just plain aren't that many of us left. Says, the profound mistake of Reverend Wright's sermons is not that he spoke about racism in our society, it's that he spoke as if our society was static, as if no progress has been made, as if this country, blah, 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 is still irrevocably bound to a tragic past. Again, this is the progressive vision. Everything that went before, everything before today was horrible and miserable. Today's a little bit better. Tomorrow's going to be perfect. That's why you see flags that are like, you know, red, black, gold, you know, the bloody struggle, the black of the past, the bloody struggle of the present, and the golden future. That's a kind of communist memes. But, in fact, the past was, in many measurable ways, far better than today. The Jews don't acknowledge any of that, though, when it comes to anything before their communist takeover in the 60s. Those are the bad old days, and they relentlessly mock them whenever the subject arises, and often make movies specifically to mock them, like Pleasantville. And so society must always be measured in their eyes from how Jews were treated and how blacks were treated, rather than how free and productive whites were and how pleasant and civilized things act. Says, the profound mistake of Reverend Wright's sermons is not that he spoke about racism in our society, it's that he spoke as if our society was static, as if no progress has been made, as if this country, blah, 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 is still irrevocably bound to a tragic past. Again, this is the progressive vision. Everything that went before, everything before today was horrible and miserable. Today's a little bit better. Tomorrow's going to be perfect. That's why you see flags that are like, you know, red, black, gold, you know, the bloody struggle, the black of the past, the bloody struggle of the present, and the golden future. That's a kind of communist memes. But, in fact, the past was, in many measurable ways, far better than today. The Jews don't acknowledge any of that, though, when it comes to anything before their communist takeover in the 60s. Those are the bad old days, and they relentlessly mock them whenever the subject arises, and often make movies specifically to mock them, like Pleasantville. And so society must always be measured in their eyes from how Jews were treated and how blacks were treated, rather than how free and productive whites were and how pleasant and civilized things act. Says the profound mistake of Reverend Wright's sermons is not that he spoke about racism in our society, it's that he spoke as if our society was static, as if no progress has been made, as if this country, blah blah blah, is still irrevocably bound to a tragic past. Again, this is the progressive vision. Everything that went before, everything before today was horrible and miserable. Today's a little bit better. Tomorrow's going to be perfect. That's why you see flags that are like, you know, red, black, gold, you know, the bloody struggle, the black of the past, the bloody struggle of the present, and the golden future. That's a kind of communist memes. But in fact, the past was in many measurable ways far better than today. The Jews don't acknowledge any of that, though, when it comes to anything before their communist takeover in the 60s. Those are the bad old days, and they relentlessly mock them whenever the subject arises, and often make movies specifically to mock them, like Pleasantville. And so society must always be measured in their eyes from how Jews were treated and how blacks were treated, rather than how free and productive whites were and how pleasant and civilized things act. We had a bit of a glitch there. I don't know if it erased or not, but what we're saying here is that he says, in the white community, the path to a more perfect union means acknowledging that what ails the African-American community is not just in the minds of black people, that the legacy of discrimination and current incidents of discrimination, while less overt than in the past, are real and must be addressed, not just with words, but with deeds, by investing our schools and our communities, enforcing our civil rights. So he's saying what we need, he's saying that the nigger rabble-rousers, like his pastor, are wrong. America has changed. Like today, look, tens of billions of dollars are spent in nigger communities each year. In fact, over $1 trillion has been wasted trying to turn blacks into humans. It's ultimately, utterly failed. And the only reason he can carry off this charade that America has changed for the better is that they ignore the ways in which America has changed for the worse. And those worse ways amount to a veritable war against whites, whether in the courts or in the streets. In the courts, we see whites are discriminated against, like Frank Kelleher. And in the streets, we see that they're beaten down, like Shannon Christian and Chris Newsom. And, you know, these kids who, this disabled woman and her kid who were attacked by these blacks, said, you can't come to the park, you have to pay a white fee, and they beat the hell out of them. This is the stuff that is never discussed by the mainstream media or the mainstream politicians. We're all supposed to just look the other way while niggers terrorize whites. And the Jews media tries to deny whites any kind of political voice whatsoever. You don't hear people talking like I do on TV. You don't even find them talking like I do in the paleoconservative websites, because they're censored by the very same Jews. Jews like Paul Gottfried go out of their way to deny all this is happening. Well, he does a subspecies of denial. He does a misattribution of blame. He doesn't blame the Jews. He blames these various non-individual technocratic explanations. Oh, there's a managerial state. That's why we have all these. It's not the Jews who took over the country and are sicking the niggers and the whites. You know, you blame technocrats and the managerial state. It's garbage. The Jews define responsibility and respectability that the middle class fear to depart from. And they will always define that in a way that whites are guilty and must be made to pay increasing amounts of respect and money to subsidize these utterly, by nature, incapacitous blacks. We're incapable of anything. And always, always, always the reason that they don't measure up is due to our racism, our attitudes, and our beliefs. But it isn't true. Whites should not accept it. They should not accept any politician who goes along with that lie. And they all do. The Republicans and the conservatives equally as the left and the Democrats. There's no bigger promoter of the lie of racial equality than Newt Gingrich and Jack Kemp and these other neocon shills put up there by Big Jew, who actually runs the country and runs Obama. He says, we have a choice in this country. We can accept a politics that breeds division and conflict and cynicism. And, you know, that's another thing. They love attributing negative, motives to their opponents, does the left, so that if someone says, look, it's obvious the races are incompatible. They don't look, smell, act, behave the same. They don't have the same capacity for learning or developing civilizations. Let's let them go their separate ways. And then they say, well, you're being cynical. And we say, well, no, we're not being cynical. We have a record of what happens when you forcibly mix them together. It results in this effective race war that is highly damaging and injurious to the white humans who built America. Above all, let's not kill the golden white goose that built America. Well, they don't care about that. They love to see whites killed off, discriminated against in the law courts, mocked on TV, beaten down in the streets. They have no problem with that. They love it. They get off on it. They love talking equality out of one side of their mouth, while on the other side they're talking about only those who are members of protected classes can file discrimination suits. How can you be a member of a protected class that is legally discriminated in favor of and file a suit against someone who's a member of a non-protected class? Only in America. Let's see. Yeah, you know, what he's got here is standard leftist progressive bilge and the usual blame all the corporations and anybody who ever earned any money. They owe. They are guilty. They must pay more. And pretending that what you're doing is some holy religious cause. I think that essentially what Obama has to offer white America is more of the same. That's why there's nothing really remarkable about his speech. It's more of the same old shakedown. You know, you owe blacks, you owe blacks, you owe blacks. They will never depart from that. They're saying it in Mugabe today. Mugabe's saying that in Zimbabwe today. Jacob Zuma is saying that in South Africa today. It's a legacy of apartheid. It's a legacy of British colonialism that's responsible for niggers starving to death because they're too damn dumb to do anything but flip rocks and find grubs. They're probably not even very good at that. So what Obama has to say is no departure from the going line for both parties, which is that whites are guilty and must be made to pay in ever larger amounts, and they must do their mea culpas with increasing frequency and fervidness. Let's listen to a couple more songs, and then we'll talk about something a little more pleasant than Obama, and that will be the debate over the little people and whether or not Homo floresiensis is in fact a new species, and we'll just talk a little bit about anthropology, and we'll talk about anthropology and corruption, and who came to America first, and when human beings started, and what human beings actually are, and the way that these things are misrepresented in the media. And what am I going to play for y'all now? Let's see. All right, I think I got it set up. I'll tell you after we played it. We're going to hear. We're going to hear four songs this set, and then we'll come back.
There I was, completely wasting, out of work and down. All inside, it's so frustrating, and the trip from town to town. Breaking the law, breaking the law, breaking the law, breaking the law.
Kassel, nach Hüppenholland. Über Magdeburg, Braunschweig, Hannover, Osnabrück.
Meine Damen und Herren, bedanken Sie mich, Ladies und Gentlemen, I give you that international sensation, Fräulein Sally Bowles. Good is sitting alone in your room. Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Put down the knitting, the book and the broom. It's time for a holiday. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Come taste the wine. Come hear the band. Come blow your horn. Start celebrating. Right this way, your table's waiting. What good's permitting some prophet of doom to wipe every smile away? Life is a cabaret, old chum. So come to the cabaret. I used to have this girlfriend known as Elsie, with whom I shared four sordid rooms in Chelsea. She wasn't what you'd call a blushing flower. As a matter of fact, she rented by the hour. The day she died, the neighbors came to snicker. Well, that's what comes from too much pills and liquor. But when I saw her laid out like a queen, she was the happiest corpse I'd ever seen. I think of Elsie to this very day. I remember how she turned to me and said, what good is sitting all alone in your room? Come, hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. And as for me, I made my mind up back in Chelsea. When I go, I'm going like Elsie. Start by admitting from cradle to tomb, it isn't that long a stay. Life is a cabaret, old chum. It's only a cabaret.
I got my first real six string, rolled it out the five and dime, played it till my fingers bled. Was the summer of 69. Me and some guys from school had a band and we tried real hard. Jimmy quit, Jody got married. Should've known we'd never get far.
All right, that was Guns N' Roses Yesterday. Before that, we heard Bryan Adams, Summer of 69. And we heard Liza Minnelli singing Life is a Cabaret from the musical Cabaret, or the movie Cabaret. And to kick it off, we heard Judas Priest, Breaking the Law, Breaking the Law. And let's see, now we're going to talk about a little anthropology and discuss a project by the Ford Foundation to go around the country and lie about race, much after the way that Barack Obama and his progressives lie about race. And we're also going to talk a little about peopling in the Americas and how that's proved by evidence and stories that you haven't heard too much about. But we'll kick it off. I read earlier in the week that their best estimate now is that the universe is like 13.7 billion years old. So, you know, I always talk about how we like to put things in context. Well, that's kind of about the biggest context there is. And if you think about that, if there are human-like creatures that appeared maybe 2 million years ago, then obviously we are a very recent phenomenon in the universe. And we haven't formed a more perfect union yet, obviously. But there's still a lot that's unknown, and they continue to make new discoveries every week, pretty much, if you check Google or a non-Jew search engine. And let's see, here we have a release from George Washington University, which is outside of Washington, D.C. Researchers at the George Washington University present new evidence to support the theory that the fossil species Homo floresiensis, known as the Hobbit, represents a unique human lineage that diverged from our own possibly as long as 1.7 million years ago, and strikes another blow against the idea that human evolution occurred in a linear progression. The research appears in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Now, I think that it's just interesting, and we want to talk about the ideological aspect of anthropology, and essentially what they want to assert is that mankind came out of Africa, and they don't really care if the facts are there to support that or not. They don't really care if that's a possible conclusion that they draw tentatively and prematurely. They don't care because it fits what they want to believe. Just as they want to believe that mankind came out of Africa, they want to believe that red men, i.e. Asians, were the first to people the Americas. But neither of these beliefs increasingly can be sustained. There's still a little more to back the Africa one, but there's nothing to back the yellows or reds were the first ones in America. In fact, there's evidence against it. But before all these people came about, it's just the point of the Homo floresiensis is that there's so much that they don't know that they shouldn't be drawing some of these conclusions that they are. They shouldn't draw any more conclusions than the evidence warrants. And so here they're still finding these new little people. And I guess there are two strains of thought. One thought says that these were not really a different type of people. They're just, they have microcephaly. They have little tiny brains due to bad nutrition or bad diet or a disease. But they're actually like other hominids that were found in the area. And the area is, you know, this is the Pacific Islands. This is the island of Palau is where they found these bones from 25 different of these little suckers in a cave. And let's see. The skeletal remains found in Indonesia in 2003 have been dubbed Hobbit because of their small stature and the small brain of the one individual with a skull, known as Liang Bua 1 or LB1. The skeleton indicates that it was a full-grown adult female but stood only 3 feet tall and had a brain about one-third the size of modern adult humans. Scientists have debated whether the remains, which cover a span from before 38,000 years ago to at least 18,000 years ago, represent modern human individuals who suffered from a disorder that caused their small build and brain size versus a new human species, Homo floresiensis. So I want to believe it's a new human species, but I'm open to evidence that it's not. But anyway, those are the two strains of thought. Either it's a new species or it's defective. You know, I guess humans, like some other animals, some animals grow to the size of their container, like fish or different amphibians or reptiles, can grow or stay small depending on available food and the size of their aquarium, say, if you're keeping something in an aquarium. And perhaps they're thinking it was this way with these people. They were on an island, they didn't have very good food, and so they stayed really small. Who knows? It's interesting, though. But here's what one scientist on one side of the debate says. He says, this should be the final nail in the coffin of the exotic pathological, that would be the microcephaly, explanations of the H. floresiensis material, but doubtless advocates of such explanations will find yet more ingenious ways of explaining away one of the most exciting, if not the most exciting and intriguing, paleoanthropological discoveries, said co-author Bernard Wood, George Washington University professor and director of the Hominid Paleobiology Doctoral Program. The thought that these creatures coexisted in time, if not in the same location, with modern humans emphasizes the extent to which evolution can still hold surprises for us. And it was about this time when you had the Solutrians over in Iberia, in Spain, Portugal, and France, who were building these tools that in the America would come to be known as the Clovis spear points, with bifacial napping, these certain techniques for making an arrowhead to kill animals. And they were making these in Europe, you know, 19,000 years ago, and they're saying that these suckers in Papua, these hobbits, these Homo floreses, as I like to call them, were around 38,000 to 18,000 years ago. So there's some overlap with these creatures in Europe who came over to the Americas, these white men, these Europeans, who invented this kind of spear point that's now found throughout the Americas, all the way to Malibu, as we'll read in just a second. You know, maybe they had some congress with these suckers over in Asia, but probably not. The point is the big point here is there's a lot that's not known, and anytime someone claims that they know what's going on, well, it's usually invalidated by a discovery in the next week, if not the next day, and these things have to be taken with a grain of salt. When someone says, oh, the human race came out of Africa, they don't know that. They're speculating based upon scanty evidence and may well be suppressing other evidence, just like the liberals say, well, these are the Enlightenment and was, you know, better than the Middle Ages, and clearly the Civil Rights Revolution, Civil Rights times are much better than the preceding decades. And you say, well, let's have recourse to the facts of the matter. Let's look at the facts. By every sociological index that we have, or by most of them, things were better before civil rights, not after them. And they don't want to hear that. They don't want to talk about that. They don't want any reduction to facts and evidence. They want to spin their grand theories. They're in line with their ideology. It helps them attack whites. All their ideologies help them attack whites and undercut what whites have done and undermine their self-respect. That's what they use anthropology for. Anthropology used to be all this simply bones and data and honest white men, usually WASPs or Germans, going off to different lands and on some kind of a crazy idea, like Heinrich Schliemann discovering Troy, having an idea and going out and researching it and finding what they found and reporting it faithfully. That's what honest anthropology is. And then slowly over time, you know, as we develop new techniques and new technologies for making discoveries, the historical picture fills in as long as people are honest. But that's not how the Jew wants to do it. The Jew starts with a preconceived notion and then selects or distorts things to fit that notion. And we had the Jew Franz Boas come over here and found anthropology essentially as an academic discipline, or at least the branch or division known as cultural anthropology, which insists that races are equal. And you can see how that ties in with a perverse interpretation of the intentions and even literal words of the men who wrote the Constitution, which we discussed earlier in relation to Barack Obama's speech. So they use the lies of their bogus school of anthropology, claiming that all cultures are equal, and this culture is no better than that, to undergird their political lies. So it becomes all of a piece, and their lies about the origins of race, the meaning of race, the reality of race, and how people have taken race into account in the past. Lie, 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 lie. A whole web of lies aimed to present one false picture to the world and to suppress any resistance to it by anyone who tries to paint a different picture. That's what we're doing here. We're saying the universe is there. They're saying right now it's 13.7 billion years old. Okay. Mankind's only been around for, you know, maybe say 5 million years, the earliest sort of hominid types. Not Homo sapiens, but hominid types. Then you got Homo sapiens popping up, and then you have different divisions within Homo sapiens, and one of them may be this Homo floresiensis over in Indonesia, and you have Europeans developing, coming over here to the Americas and building tools. There's all these little bits and pieces of information that you can gather to create a true picture of what's going on in the world. And you have to do it from shows like this and from researching and putting the facts together yourself, because there are lots of interested parties who will tell you lies no matter which way you turn. So I just like talking about this because I think it's kind of interesting. But anyway, they have well, there's new evidence that this is actually a new species. Let's see what they say. The GW researchers Adam Gordon, Lisa Neville, and Bernard Wood developed a novel way to compare the shape of the hobbit's skull with what the shape of modern human skulls would be like in individuals as small as the hobbit. Using these new methods, they have shown that the hobbit's skull is shaped nothing like that of modern humans. Of a modern human, whether or not size differences are taken into account. Instead, it is similar to our possible ancestors belonging to the species Homo erectus and Homo habilis, found in Africa and the Republic of Georgia, which are about 1.7 million years old. You may remember we also, oh my God, I think it was on this show, or was it on one of the other shows we were talked about? No, I think I just posted it on the VNN in the anthropology section, vnnforum.com. They found remains in a cave in Spain that pushed back the date of the earliest Western Europeans from 800,000 years ago, and that was, as they say here, somewhere over in Georgia, to like 1.2 million. So those are the earliest remains they found in Europe, or 1.2 million years ago. So they're saying that what George Washington has done that's new here with Homo floresiensis is compare its brain shape and volume to modern humans to see if it's different shape as a result of disease or if it's just simply a different type of creature. And they're saying it's a different species. They say basically it's like Homo erectus or Homo habilis that existed one point in that range, 1 to 2 million years ago in Africa and Asia, and probably in Europe too. I'm not sure what those were in Europe, if they were, let me see that. I'll dig that up here in a second. They have, let's see. I made my own rule of, maybe, for all I know, an anthropologist and archaeologist has already come up with this, but to me, extracting from what I know of anthropology is that, as I wrote, a reliable rule of anthropology is that X happened a lot earlier than we think today, and subsequent discoveries, like the one below, will prove it. You know, so they think, oh, man, is this old, but then they always end up finding something that proves it was actually there earlier. Like a couple other recent discoveries. Fossils push back bipedalism to 6 million years ago. So, see, I already said something false earlier in the show. I said, you know, these human-like creatures were around 5 million years, well, around 6 million years ago. The ability to walk upright on two legs began at the dawn of human evolution more than 6 million years ago. Right? So, The first detailed examination of the fossilized thigh bones of a 4-foot-tall creature called Ororin tugenensis, I don't know how they pronounce that, supports the notion that this very early member of the hominin family was bipedal. So 6 million years ago, people beginning to walk on their hind feet, and they can prove that with bones. And they found those bones in Kenya, so that would support the out-of-Africa theory. And that's where they found Lucy at Olduvai Gorge, which is the one that most people are familiar with. But then also in what they found in Spain recently, they found the oldest human remains in Western Europe. As I said, they found a jawbone and teeth were discovered at the Atapuerca site in northern Spain, have been dated between 1.1 and 1.2 million years ago. So you've got those, and you've got the stuff in Georgia, and you have other stuff in Africa that's even older. And then you've got the Florenziensis over in... they have a little map here, and they have from a Nature Journal, and they're trying to show how humans developed. And we are of the species Homo sapiens, they claim. And they sort of show... They show it originating in Africa. They have it divided into East Asia, Southeast Asia, Africa, and Europe. A graph or a chart, and they show 2 million years ago our whole human line spreading from Africa, going from Africa forward, 1.6 million Homo ergaster and Homo georgicus, and then forward again to 1.2 million Homo, you've got, and then down to 800,000 years ago, you've got Homo erectus in East Asia and Southeast Asia. Then you go forward to about 500,000 years ago, Homo antecessor. I guess that line died out. And then you've got Homo heidelbergensis about 400,000 years ago, developing into Homo neanderthalus, which died out, and then Homo sapiens. It's the other branch of the Homo heidelbergensis. Came out of those earlier preforms. And then there, it looks like they're speculating that Homo erectus was more in Asia. Homo heidelbergensis is more in Africa and Europe. One of the branches of Homo erectus turns out to be Homo floresiensis. But, you know, all this stuff is kind of speculative and subject to further review and revision in light of new finds. So it's all... It ain't written in stone, although the discoveries are made in stone, usually. I think it's pretty interesting. And what do we have here? So anyway, that I track this stuff every couple of weeks, and that's what they've been finding. In that was March 20th that they found the fossil. They reported on the fossil that pushed back bipedalism to 6 million years ago. People start walking on their back legs. And this is how you want to understand history. You want to have first a timeline, and then you, on that skeleton, you put on the flesh of individual stories or people or characters or times or periods. But you know, you have the overall picture in your mind of this, of the general time frame, so that you know where to hang stuff. Now, let's see. What have I got here? Okay, so they've studied the Homo floresiensis, and they're saying there's no way now these suckers can claim that disease or pathology had anything to do with it. And they're saying that, but we suppose they will try to claim that anyway. Anyway, that came out of the George Washington study for the Center for the Advanced Study of Hominid Paleobiology. That would probably be a pretty interesting place to study if some of you were interested in that for a graduate school or even undergraduate. I think that's about 30-40 miles outside of D.C., as I recall. What else have we got here? We've got... Of course, at viennainform.com, if you go to our anthropology subsection, you can get a number of different sticky threads in which we discuss just general human origins. That's the oldest sort of hominids that preceded our species, Homo sapiens, and then the division into races. But we've also got a thread specific to Homo floresiensis and to who came to America first, and also Tocharians. Those are the whites in China. They found a bunch of white mummies over there that give history a little bit of a different reading if you think about it. And also we have a thread on where did the white race originate. That's not as clear as it might seem. And we have a number of other different things. We also, within Human Origins, we're also looking at how, where whites evolved in Europe, or what, how they evolved in Europe. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention in this, as we continue our anthropology update, is the find that was made a couple of years ago out in Malibu, California, of all places. And, oh my gosh, come on now. Where is it here? Here it is, okay. Let me see. This is from 2007, actually, I believe, last year. And what it is I discussed Clovis points. And Clovis is the name of a site in New Mexico. And it's actually in the very, almost on the border with Texas, so it's on the east side of the state. And this is where they found, I guess, the first type of this arrowhead they found, that they named Clovis, because it was found near Clovis, New Mexico, which itself was named for one of the Merovingian kings by the daughter who was studying French of some official in that area when that town was formed, I learned from Wikipedia. But anyway, they find these arrowheads there, they name them Clovis. And these arrowheads are found in a lot of places in the Americas, but they don't think they'd ever found any in California until 2007, and they found one on a property that was being developed in Malibu. Now, there's a property owner. It's a multi-million-dollar property. It's right on the beach, more or less, I guess. And for some reason, they already knew it had been a site for the Chuka or something Indians there. And under congressional law, Native Americans have, like, you know, first and exclusive right to any kind of remains. The problem is that really, really old remains, like Kennewick Man, are not Native Americans, as they're mislabeled, but may be white people, yet the natives want to try to claim them as their own. Well, anyway, they knew this had been an Indian place, so they're digging it up in a very careful, precise way, and they precise territory. They unearthed with a backhoe a Clovis point, and basically not too much else has been done since then, from what I could tell from studying the web. But the point is, you have the demonstration of the peopling of California, and that these, if the theory is correct that these people did not come from the Bering Straits, from Asia, that they came from Iberia, then this would show how far they'd gone, because you can't get any farther west than Malibu. It's on the ocean. And so if these points, the technology used to make this point, originated in France, Spain, and Portugal, it shows that whites spread all the way across the continent rather than from Asia. And see, what it was the earlier theory was that whites came over from when the last ice age ended and the snows dried up, there was revealed a footbridge that allowed these Asians to come over from Siberia and make their way down through the Americas and quickly spread out. But the problem is that the technology that the people use in Asia is not the technology used to make Clovis. They had different types of things that they used, like micro blades or something, compared to these fluted, bifacially cut arrowheads. That is, they cut little, it's called napping, and they chip away at this stuff, and they cut little chunks out of it, and then they build a flute up the middle, and then they wrap that between a stick, and they wrap it up, and then it becomes a spear. Well, it's not how they do it in Asia, apparently. And so they coined, some of the anthropologists who are of the school that the people who made the Clovis technology came from Europe rather than Asia, called it Iberia, not Siberia, in a phrase. And it's somewhat mocked in the media, and they try to cover it up. We've talked about Kennewick Man before and how they found this European skeleton. And to get some of the media pressure off, I mean, the guy who first studied it, the white scientist, said that it was, you know, maybe partly Polynesian or whatever. He kind of covered up the truth to relieve political pressure, but in private he has told people that we know that, no, in fact, it was a white, very definitely white Kennewick Man, and the Clinton administration went in and dumped thousands of tons of rock and soil in the location the Kennewick Man was located. And this is a skeleton of one of these people using a Clovis point. And these would have been Europeans who came over from Europe before the red man came over from Asia. So they were coming over, 1,000 years ago. Whereas the Asians did not come until after that. But anyway, Gary Stickle is kind of the professor who's associated with this finding of this Clovis point in Malibu. Let's just read a little what he says. And I guess they're fighting the property owner, or they were last year. There doesn't seem to be much of an update on it, although he has set up a blog that I have linked, vnnforum.com, in the anthropology part. You can find under Europeans or the First Americans thread, we have the relevant papers. I'll read just the basics of the theory. First Americans may have been European. The first humans to spread across North America may have been seal hunters from France and Spain. This runs counter to the long-held belief that the first human entry into the Americas was a crossing of a land ice bridge that spanned the Bering Strait about 13,500 years ago. The new thinking was outlined here Sunday at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The tools don't match. Recent studies have suggested that the glaciers that helped form the bridge connecting Siberia and Alaska began receding around 17,000 to 13,000 years ago, leaving very little chance that people walked from one continent to the other. Also, when archaeologist Dennis Stanford in the Smithsonian Institute places American spearheads called Clovis points side by side with Siberian points, he sees a divergence of many characteristics. Instead, Stanford said today, Clovis, and this was in, 2006, he's saying this. Yeah, 2006. Just about 2 years ago from when I'm speaking. Stanford said, and he's one of the big names, Clovis points match up much closer with Solutrean-style tools, which researchers date to about 19,000 years ago. This suggests that the American people making Clovis points made Solutrean points before that. They made the Solutrean points in Europe, and the Clovis was a development of Solutrean technology here in America. There's just one problem with this hypothesis. Solutrean toolmakers lived in France and Spain. Scientists know of no land ice bridge that spanned that entire gap. Stanford has an idea for how humans crossed the Atlantic through boats. Art from that era indicates that the Solutrean populations in northern Spain were hunting marine animals such as seals, walrus, and tuna. They may have made their way into the floating ice chunks that unite immense harp seal populations in Canada and Europe each year. 4 million seals, Stanford said, would look like a pretty good meal to hungry European hunters who might have ventured into the ice floes much the same way that the Inuit in Alaska and Greenland do today. Inuit use large open hunting boats constructed from animal skins for long trips or big hunts. These boats, called umiak, can hold a dozen adults as well as several children, dead seals or walruses, and even dog sled teams. Inuit have been building these boats for thousands of years, and Stanford believes that Solutrean people may have used a similar design. It's possible that some of these hunters ventured out as far as Iceland, where they may have gotten caught up in the prevailing currents and were carried to North America. You get three boats loaded up like this and you would have a viable population, Stanford said. You could actually get a whole bunch of people washing up in Nova Scotia. That's up in northeast Canada. Some scientists believe that the Solutrean people were responsible for much of the cave art in Europe. Opponents of Stanford work ask, why then would these people stop producing art once they made it to North America? I don't know, Stanford said, but you're going a long distance inland, 100 miles or so, before they would get to caves to do art in. So he's saying they went around the northern rim and the ice chunks chasing seals, and they came down through Labrador and the coast there in Canada, and then spread through the Americas as documented by the tools. And this is kind of the semi-underground view of what actually happened. I say semi-underground because there are people who will discuss it above ground, but they're very careful in what they say. They don't come out like I am and give it a real hard political spin and say, look, the fact of the matter is the Clintons and the Jews are lying. Whites were in America first. And they're using the big lie that Reds were here first to inculcate guilt in our children in order to wipe them out. wipe out all our posterity by lying about our past. And that's exactly what's going on, because it's not just in this case, it's in every single case. Just as they lie that we are guilty for the plight of the black man, they lie that we are guilty for wiping out the Native Americans. Well, A, they aren't Native Americans, and B, they wiped our kind out. The Reds coming over from Asia wiped out the whites who were already here from Europe. So when the whites returned, you know, 500 years ago, they were returning to a continent they had inhabited first. But you won't hear a word of this in any public school. That's why we focus on homeschooling in each one of these shows. And there are various, and we have different videos talking about the different skeletons that have been found in the Americas that are of European origin. Spirit Cave mummies, Lovelock mummies, Kennewick Man, Buell Cave woman, Pinon woman the third. A 13,000-year-old Caucasoid in Mexico, right? And then you'll find lots of these videos at Pod Blanc and at other places, and they document what I'm saying here. We have links to them at vnnforum.com. Let's get a little more about this Clovis point that they found as far west as California, where Malibu goes into the sea. You know, they talk about this Gary Stickler, archaeologist, as Indiana Jones, fighting to preserve an 11,000-year-old archaeological site on Point Dume, D-U-M-E, or maybe it's Dume, I don't know, Point Dume, off the Pacific Coast Highway, which he says could hold the DNA answer to whether the first human beings in America were Asian or European. Now, note, just as they dumped all this soil on Kennewick Man's site, where they found Kennewick Man, here they don't want to give it a historical designation. They want to just let the property owner, you know, here they're all about property rights, whereas if a sand flea, if an endangered species of sand flea had been discovered at this site, they wouldn't let the property owner do anything. But because the tool that they found threatens their cover story about whites committing genocide against Native Americans, they want to bury it. They don't want to give it any recognition. What's happening here is barbaric, says Dr. Stickle, standing outside the barricades around the site. Our history is important. And if it's not important to her, the landowner, it's important to many Americans and other people. Dr. Stickle's struggle began 6 years ago when the lot was bought for development. Under Malibu's building code, all sites must be surveyed for historical artifacts. In 2005, Edgar Perez, a Native American, according to the reporter, was helping to monitor the work, sifting through the dirt. I was over there by that tree, says Dr. Stickle, and Edgar starts yelling at me. You gotta see this. He was holding up this thing, this spear tip, and I said, oh my God. The spear tip was found to be up to 11,000 years old, and distinctive fluted flakes on its base suggested that it belonged to the Clovis culture, named for the New Mexico site where the first such artifact was discovered in 1932. The culture is the subject of intense debate between archaeologists and Native Americans. The reporter takes the side in that by calling them Native Americans. Dr. Stanford argues that because no spear tips, known as Clovis points, have been found in Siberia, from where the first Americans were supposed to have arrived, they must have come from the East Coast via ice sheets linked with Europe, where there is a trail of Clovis discoveries. They were from Iberia, not Siberia, he once said of these settlers, who arrived 15,000 years before Columbus. Native Americans are outraged at the idea that they might be related to those who infected them with smallpox and stole their land. Well, that's only half the story, and even that is exaggerated. They don't tell you about what the Native Americans infected the Europeans with. Dr. Stickle argues that any human remains could put an end to this debate with DNA evidence. Basically, what Stickle is trying to do is put public pressure on people to get this declared a historical site and allow him to do further excavations, but so far that has not been working. There's no further mention of it that I can find anyway. It's called Far Point, this site where they found this Clovis point in Malibu, California. here's what, and the, and he has a blog, and I have it linked at viennainform.com in the anthropology section. And one of the letters that was written, that was, or one of the postings either made on the news story or on his own blog says, ever since President Clinton had the Army Corps of Engineers bury the Kennewick Man site in Washington State under 150,000 tons of rock and gravel to obliterate all archaeological evidence there, there has been an undeclared war against digs that would suggest Europeans were the original Native Americans. I fear that this does not bode well for the real-life Indiana Jones, who is Dr. Stickler. Interesting. Well, let's see. And what Stanford says, and he's kind of the father of the Iberia, not Siberia, theory. Stanford says about this specific far point discovery of the Clovis spear point. He says, the discovery of a Clovis Age occupation at the site is extremely important, not only for the local archaeological record, but for understanding the earliest prehistory of the Americas. Hence, the site is of national significance and requires an interdisciplinary research program and protection. But, of course, that has not been done. Everything that will in any way aid whites or apologize for their actions is denied by a seemingly invisible hand, but ultimately we know that that hand is connected to the Jew. The Jew is the author of all of these mysterious problems that white people face when trying to act like ordinary whites, you know, do historical research or be hired and promoted at a government office. All these things where they're not even like blacks, they're not failing, they're merely having obstacles thrown in their way for no reason but their race by their racial competitor, the Jew, who tries to deny them the knowledge they need to understand what's happening. That's what we're here doing this show, you know, at 5:41 in the morning to let you understand. And what we have is Stickle has written letters to different people, and they've chipped in their opinion of this, and I don't know. I haven't seen anything new on this. If you have, let me know. I'll read a little bit from a little paper. Gary Stickle, principal archaeologist for the Far Point Project. And the name of his paper is The Far Point Site, a unique Clovis culture site of the first Americans on the Malibu coast, by Dr. E. Gary Stickle, principal archaeologist for the Far Point Project. In his second paragraph, he says, there are two theories for the origins of the Clovis culture. The traditional theory is that Clovis represents ancient Native Americans who immigrated across the Bering Land Bridge between Siberia and Alaska, and from there made their way ever south until both North and South America were inhabited. However, according to Dr. Dennis Stanford, there are no antecedents for the Clovis spearheads in Asia, whereas there are in ancient Europe. So, like, the spear point they found... Maybe I'm beating this point into the ground, but it seems to me worth repeating. Dennis Stanford, who's the main guy here, is backing up Stickle and saying, look, they find this point here. These points don't come from Asia. We can't find anything like these Clovis points in Asia, but we do find stuff like the Clovis points in Europe, you know, 18, 19,000 years ago. And that's the origin of the technology that developed into the Clovis Point, because I guess it's an improvement on what the Solutrians did. They got better at the napping. So, there are no antecedents for Clovis spearheads in Asia, whereas there are in ancient Europe. Therefore, he believes that Clovis people originated from the Solutrean culture of what is now Spain and France, and coursing their way on boats along the coastlines of northwest Europe, and then westward around Iceland, Greenland, and Nova Scotia, and then southward along the Atlantic seaboard until they reached what is now the southeast United States. From there, the Clovis proliferated and expanded westward, inhabiting virtually every state until the Far Point site was reached at the continent's end. That's in Malibu. Let's see. As Dr. Stanford recently stated, I have examined the Clovis biface from the Far Point site. There is no question that the artifact was made using Clovis technology and thereby indicates that the site was occupied by Clovis people over 11,000 years ago. Huh. The discovery of a Clovis Age occupation at the site is extremely important, not only for the local archaeological record, but for understanding the earliest prehistory of the Americas. Hence, the site is of national significance and requires an interdisciplinary research program and protection. He says, until the discovery of the Farpoint site, no in-situ Clovis Age sites are known along the west coast of the Americas. So it establishes kind of a new westernmost point of the Clovis culture. And there can't be anything farther west unless there are islands off the coast of California, I suppose. But maybe they find some Clovis points in the Catalinas would be the only thing that would top this. But, you see, all this stuff is pretty much underground because no one knows about it, because all they know is the Indians came here first, and then the evil white man arrived from Europe and genocided them all. But that's not the truth. Now, let's see. What else do we have to talk about? Let's take a little break here, not too long, and then we'll come back and we'll conclude by talking about a white privilege conference that's going on practically as we speak. In fact, I think it starts today, and we'll talk about a little bit about the left taking over the academy and some of their different ideas and memes. But we'll take a little bit of a break. And I'll continue to update the anthropology every couple of shows, and as they find new stuff and I hear more about these stories. But that came out, 1 to 2 years ago, and I haven't heard anything more about that recently. What do we play? Play a little more. I'm going to play some Queen Alphaville and then Oingo Boingo. And then we'll come back. And then we will come back and do our final segment, and then we'll wrap it up with a couple songs at that point.
Every day, I try. rhythm,
someone to love.
I got no rhythm, I just keep losing my beat.
You just keep losing,
I'm alright.
He's alright, he's alright.
I just gotta get out of this prison cell.
One day I'm gonna be free.
Somebody to love, find me 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 somebody to love,
somebody to love.
Any
Okay, we're back, and that was Oingo Boingo, Dead Man's Party. You'll probably remember that from the 80s. Before that, we heard Alphaville, Summer in Berlin, Queen Somebody to Love, and that was all we played in that little break, that brief interlude. Now we're back for our final segment. We're going to talk about white privilege and also institutionalized anthropology as opposed to the real thing that we discussed last segment. And we have... Before we get to the conference that's beginning today in Massachusetts at Amherst, we have a touring show, an exhibit called Race, that's being sponsored by the Ford Foundation. Ford Foundation is one of the most destructive agencies, private agencies or quasi-private agencies in the history of the country. I believe they more or less single-handedly created the Mexican La Raza. The idea that Mexicans are a race and they have a cause and they belong in the U.S. and they deserve all the same civil rights as blacks, blah, blah, blah. Well, now they have headed by this ridiculous-looking black woman, a touring show called Race that brings together, the everyday experience of living with race, its history as an idea. Race is not an idea, it's a fact. The role of science in that history and the findings of contemporary science that are challenging its foundations. Now, you can guess what the intended lesson of this exhibit is. And it's always the same old leftist progressive garbage that you're supposed to learn. And they are by no means are they above falsifying science to serve their agenda. Just as we see with global warming, they will use science because science is more respectable than communism, which is what they have to offer. They will trick out their communism as science, whether it's global warming or whether it's race-free anthropology. Race doesn't exist, but you must discriminate against whites, and you must give all these advantages to coloreds. That's their view. They have no trouble with contradictions. Like I said, you know, you go one of two ways. You either go to the right and the realistic school, in which you're forced to resolve contradictions, or you go to the left where anything goes. And you kill anyone who resists your plan. So, the important thing is this is corporate-backed, Ford Foundation-backed, headed by a no-doubt incompetent black woman, and sponsored or developed by the American Anthropological Association. So, it has every kind of official backing you could want. And they call this the first nationally traveling exhibition to tell the stories of race from the biological, cultural, and historical points of view. I wonder if they'll have one of the whites who was victimized when they stuck the niggers in his public high school down in Arkansas, who was beat up by them. Do you think his story is out there, or is that one of the voices they're going to stifle in the name of diversity? What do you think? Is anything in this country run honestly? Not really. Are the banks run honestly? No. Are the politics run honestly? No. How's the Social Security Administration run? Well, it discriminates against whites also. You imagine a traveling circus is more likely to be run honestly than a touring exhibit of a race that purports to treat it factually. The chair that I referred to disparagingly earlier is Yolanda Moses, who's a black woman with a vaguely Kenta sackcloth-ish scarf or wrap or something over her shoulder of her tan pantsuit. And what is she? Well, she is a PhD chair, Understanding Race and Human Variation, Vice Provost for Diversity and Conflict Resolution, and Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Riverside. That's one of the less respected California system schools. Ford Foundation gave this race project $450,000. And the name of the project is Race, Are We So Different? Question. The left loves that way of putting things. Of course, there's always an answer to it, the question that it poses. It's always challenging conventional wisdom, never itself representing conventional unwisdom, or a big lie wrapped up as wisdom. It's always challenging the establishment view that race exists and matters, although that's hardly the establishment view. Now, this black woman was president of the American Anthropological Association when discussions about the race project began in the late 1990s. And we see how this ties into what we discussed earlier. America is ready to have a substantive conversation about race, as witnessed by the dialogue around Barack Obama's recent speech on race, said Moses. This project will provide educational information on this most important topic to more Americans than ever. Now, we're supposed to have this substantive conversation, but it's just like Carol Swaim's book about white nationalism. They're never going to address the scientific facts of the matter, and they're going to ignore that whites have no interest in any conversation. Whites have an interest in separation. The facts show that blacks are more violent, less intelligent, and have lower impulse control than do whites. And these and other differences make the two races essentially irreconcilable. When they get mixed together, the white race suffers, especially when it isn't allowed to know about the problem or understand its source or extent, because the media are in the hands of a third race called Jews, who find it in their interest to mix the two races until the one kills off or intermingles away the other, the white race that they see as competitors. That's what's going on, but you'll never read about it in a controlled newspaper. I guess this original race project began at the University of Minnesota, the Science Museum of Minnesota, in January 2007. Since then, more than 1 million people have explored the exhibit and related website. And it'll be touring around until 2012. And as I said, you can bet that among the voices speaking about race and racism, you will not have any whites like Frank Kelleher, whose story we heard earlier today, nor any of the white kids who are in the forcibly integrated schools who suffered from beatings and inferior education. That will not be part of it, assuredly. And now let's look at another aspect of this, the whiteness conference. And what has happened is, over the years, there has risen a bogus academic discipline called whiteness studies. And one of the men behind this discipline is the Jew Noel Ignatieff, who wants to abolish white people. And he says, I will keep on beating live white males and dead white males until they no longer exist. And by abolish whiteness, they mean white genocide, although they will not say that directly, but that is what they mean. And what these people do is, these pseudo-academics hold conferences at Tony hotels where they bemoan white privilege. Typical is one woman we dug up, who's one of the mainstays of this conference, is a Jew. She's of my generation. She's maybe a year younger. She's about 40, and she's a PhD. And you know, what does she do? She sits back and writes a bunch of crap and goes to these conferences and lives a very nice middle-class lifestyle, essentially spreading lies and hatred against white people, and goes to conferences where she denounces white privilege. And just going into this a little bit shows you the ridiculous stuff that's circulating in the universities today. And we have a quote from a book. I have come to see white privilege as an invisible package of unearned assets which I can count on cashing in each day, but about which I was meant to remain oblivious. White privilege is like an invisible weightless knapsack of special provisions, maps, passports, codebooks, visas, clothes, tools, and blank checks. So you see, not only are whites bearers of these special negatives, and they are also bearers of special positives, so they're at once, they're guilty of racism, but they're also guilty of all these unearned privileges. It's all very mysterious and shadowy. You know, no one believes in witches anymore. We all know to ridicule that, but people believe in this kind of garbage. They believe in racism and they believe in white privilege. You know, which are two sides of the same coin. Whites get undeserved benefits, and these benefits come at the expense of the coloreds. Any honest academic discipline that studied whites would have to conclude they're more creative and capable than any other race, because they've essentially built the world, and the others are just freeloading on their experience and their ability. But that can't be said. Instead, we give these leftists, these Jews, like the woman I referred to, who herself is privileged, the people attending this conference are the privileged ones, not the whites who are essentially having money taken from them at gunpoint through the offices of the state and funded through the universities to put on these conferences. They're the ones who are privileged. It's not you out there listening to this who are paying taxes to support this kind of garbage and then turn around and be discriminated against on the job or have your kids beaten up and discriminated against in school or taught lies about their origins. There's nothing privileged about that. Whites are overtly legally discriminated against, yet all the talk is the other way. Like whites are the beneficiaries of all these unexamined, these unmerited special treatment. Well, it's not the case. Only in imagination is it the case. To the extent it refers to something real, it's simply that there's a higher common denominator when whites are dealing with whites. They have evolved a better way of living than they have with blacks. Blacks can't participate in this because they don't know how to be quiet and non-stupid and to work with others peacefully. The fact that whites do is not any measure of privilege. It's a measure of the civilizational gap between whites and muds. But of course, they don't want to say that, because everything good that whites have must have been stolen from blacks, and everything good that blacks don't have is because of white racism. So either way, whites are always guilty. Once you know that, I mean, there are 1,000 manifestations, but that's the essential point. Whites are always guilty, and they must be destroyed. And this is on the, and I have this all posted at vnnforum.com. The University of Colorado at Colorado Springs is the home of this Jewess, who is one of the two main drivers behind this conference, along with a black guy who's one of these typical purple tie wearing charlatans, who knows how to, you know, control himself well enough to, you know, steal legally, rather than steal illegally as his brothers in the hood do. And he knows that whites go in for endless amounts of this stuff. And white privilege conferences, what they basically do is they inculcate guilt feelings into white females. I don't think even too many white males go in for this unless they're professors and they make a living at it. Basically, they just teach people to take their natural racist reactions study them mentally and then respond in the religiously indicated direction, which is more or less like Amy Beale's parents. So even if they kill your daughter, well, you know, there's always a white to blame for that. Even if your white daughter goes to South Africa to help the blacks and the blacks kill her, you should still go over there and shake her hand. That's essentially what they're teaching all these white people to do, is to see themselves as the problem rather than the blacks, who would seem to be the obvious cause of the problem because of their stupidity and inability or unwillingness to learn, their ready recourse to violence, their all-around low level of behavior. Well, they're not the problem. White racism is the problem. And anytime you have like a normal reaction to anything, you have to double think. That's what they're inculcating in these people. Teach them never to accept their normal reaction to anything as valid. It's so funny because they always say that when they reverse it about coloreds, they always say that everything that coloreds see, think, hear, or feel is inherently valid. And they should never question it. But when it's whites, they're always wrong. So for everything out there, they have one standard for Jews and their colored tools and another standard for whites. If you react like this to blacks, you're the problem. And then if blacks react to whites, well, of course, you're right. Whites are the problem. It's whites can't win, heads or tails. They lose either way. And a lot of them go in for this. It's kind of a perversion of the white ability. The higher white IQ, the higher white ability to get along with others. Well, the flip side of that, or the perversion of that, or the dark side of it, is that it can be twisted into an unjustified form of racial self-criticism. I mean, it takes a lot of imagination to believe this stuff because it's so inherently implausible. You see blacks, they're violent, they're stupid, they're ugly. I mean, what more is there to see? That's how they are. Only a white person is uniquely creative and thoughtful enough to think all the way to the point where that becomes something not negative but a manifestation of some inherent white problem. It's really perverse. And it's sick. And that's why they can't ever really communicate what exactly white privilege is, because it just doesn't correspond to anything real. So they have to, okay, you know, leftism never makes sense. It's something that has to be explained 550. It's very much like Christian Science. I remember when I was a child and, you know, we'd read Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures by Mary Baker Eddy, and you read it over and you're like, God damn it, man. One of us is crazy. It's either me, Alex Rudy Linder, or it's Mary Baker Glover Patterson Eddy. And I don't think it's me, because I read this 50 times and it doesn't make one fucking inch more sense, 1 ounce more sense than it made the first time I read it. It's fucking crazy. And it's very much the same with this white privilege garbage. It's like, some people are so perverse that reality is not their starting or their ending point. They don't start with a theory and deduce from it. They don't start with the facts and induce from it. And never do they check against reality anything. So it's all castles built in the air. And it has no relation to anything real. And so they never get past, you know, stage one, which is just, here, you're going to believe this, and if you don't believe it, you're evil. So they're always hunting for heretics. Like someone said, right-wingers hunt for converts, left-wingers hunt for heretics. Because this stuff is so easy not to believe, that's why they have to hunt for heretics, because they're always suspicious people will revert to their natural reaction to niggers, which is negative. So they actually have to hold conferences to try to ingrain this stuff and inculcate it and give huge foundation grants to people to spread this garbage, because on its own it won't take. It has to be pushed on people. Here's what another presumably white male says about white privilege. And this is a Q&A from the site for the White Privilege Conference. He says, is this about proving how bad white folks are? And they always are all folksy when they talk about whites, because they don't want to give the idea that they're a specific race that is worth preserving. They never want to get to any of that endangered species feel to whiteness. So they always have to, it's either whitey or white boy or white folks. But it's never whites or the white race with capital letters. Because then you start to get into dangerous area and say, oh, you want to be serious for a moment. And you really want to talk about what white people are genetically and anthropologically and culturally. Because if you do that, there are real things to be found. And you're going to find that despite your lies, it's not all negative. In fact, it's pretty much uniquely positive. And that would be a real whiteness. In fact, what I'm doing here is real whiteness studies. What they are doing is political agitation on behalf of the Jews and the minorities that are 92% of the world's population. What I am doing is real whiteness studies. I'm telling you what white people actually are. At this whiteness, white privilege conference, you aren't going to hear that whites have the privilege of having their history in this continent denied by Jewish media and corrupt anthropologists. You're not going to hear anything like that. You're going to hear about how whites have unearned privilege because of their white skin. So even our virtues are held against us. Our flaws, they invent flaws for us, and they hold our real virtues against us. So we're bad coming, going, upside and downside, inside and out. Gary Howard says, "We can't teach what we don't know, white teachers, multiracial schools." He says, "Our attempts to dismantle dominance and oppression must follow a path other than that of either vilifying or obliterating whiteness." Okay, that's mildly positive if he doesn't want to obliterate whiteness. "Whites need to acknowledge and work through the negative historical implications of whiteness." Now, that's just flat bullshit. "And create for ourselves a transformed identity." That's a typical code word. It's more commonly found in South Africa than here, but it's becoming increasingly common in the U.S. Transformed means whites are supposed to transform themselves into pliable victims of the black, brown, Jew majority that were celebrating its arrival by 2050. So we have to transform our attitudes and our very bodies and our ways of thinking to fit in with the brown global slave plantation mentality that best serves the Jews. He says, "Our goal is neither to defy nor denigrate whiteness, but to diffuse its destructive power." So you can see they're reacting to the negative reaction to Jew Ignatieff's "We must abolish whiteness." So now they're getting kind of defensive. They're, we don't want to destroy whiteness. We want to transform it. Gary Howard says, "To teach my white students and my own children that they are not, quote, not white is to do them a disservice. To teach them that there are different ways of being white and that they have a choice as white people to become champions of justice and social healing." Again, these are code words. Social justice is an age-old Jewish code word for communism. "Is to provide them an injustice. Is to provide them a positive direction for growth and to grant them the dignity of their own being." Not really. He's saying you're only a real white. This is the left-wing equivalent of the Jews on TV saying you're only a real white. You're only allowed to be a brave, tough white man if you're off dying for Israel. That's the only form of masculinity that is positive to the Jew. The rest of the time you're supposed to be a faggot. A really wimpy, weak-ass husband who's dominated by his wife. That's what the right wing, that's what they hold out for normal Americans. For leftists, they hold out, well, you can become a real white, but only if you're basically a communist. Only if you're putting the interests of blacks, niggers, and Jews, and every other minority that is 92% of the world's population ahead of your own 8%, the tiny, precious minority, as Craig Cobb calls it. Only then are you justified in being white. Now let's look around on the site. I've got the PDF pulled up of the show, and just looking at the cover page, and I've read the entire thing. It's maybe 100 pages long, and I've gone all through it. Well, not 100, it's 48 pages long. That's the list of all the different people speaking and what they're talking about and the different groups involved sponsoring it and funding it and appearing at it. And it's just to check the organization of our enemies, and these are our enemies. The 9th Annual White Privilege Conference. Critical Liberation Praxis. Creating Transformation for Social Justice. So, I suppose it might be possible to work in another few code words into the title of their show. Standard leftist communist code words since the French Revolution, but I couldn't do it. Critical Liberation Praxis. Liberation, transformation, social justice. A program of the Matrix Center at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. So, at the other Colorado campus in Boulder, they're persecuting a satirist. Meanwhile, down at Colorado Springs, they're putting on Critical Liberation Praxis, Creating Transformation for Social Justice. Translation, we're going to make whites hate themselves and turn over all of their worldly goods to niggers and Jews. That's what it always means, taking money from you and turning it over to them. I had the same education myself as an international relations graduate of Pomona College 20 years ago, minus a month. Because our reunion is like May 2nd to 4th, I think. So this show is held April 2nd to 5th, 2008 in Springfield, Massachusetts at the, I think at UMass Amherst, which is a notable center of leftist radicalism. And again, this is the 9th Annual White Privilege Conference. And their 10th conference is going to be in Memphis, April 1 to 4, 2009. and in their introductory letter, which comes from Eddie Moore, he's the black activist I told you about, and then the other one is Abby Ferber, who is apparently a Jewess from Oregon, and the director of the Matrix Center at Colorado Springs, University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. Eddie Moore is the founder, director of diversity at the Bush School, and founder and director of the White Privilege Conference. So this is basically a fairly sophisticated way of shaking down corporations and, colleges themselves that represent shakedowns of white earners. So the very people being disparaged in this conference are the ones funding it. Most of them unwittingly and unknowingly, and the average person doesn't know about any of this crap's going on. There's virtually no one in American society who's more privileged than Eddie Moore Jr. and Abby Ferber. And in their welcome letter, they say, "We hope the conference will better equip you to take action against oppression and privilege in all of its manifestations." Sick. Should have said all of their manifestations. But being blacks and Jews, what do they know about English? "It is our hope that each of us leaves this conference having gained greater knowledge and understanding, as well as the energy to challenge the status quo and work to dismantle systems of privilege, supremacy, and oppression." Now, keep in mind, the woman talking about dismantling status quo is herself a tenured professor or a tenure track professor at a major institution. She's not really suffering. She would seem to be part of the status quo. Hers would seem to be a system of privilege, supremacy, and oppression. I mean, can you afford to take 4 or 5 days off, basically a whole week off from your job, and go party with a bunch of your friends, you know, halfway around the country? Who's paying for that? You think Abby Ferber is paying out of her pocket to go attend this conference? Hell no. Good people of Colorado are paying for it. What do they say? Another one of their letters. This is a letter put out by the Amherst, where it's being held. Amherst has a nice little rainbow bar below SJE, Social Justice Education, from the campus of the University of Massachusetts Amherst, faculty, students, and alumni, April 2, 2008. Liberation. That is what we want. Again, think about this in terms of E. Michael Jones, and we'll get back to his work before long in these Radio Astina. You know, liberation, that is what we want. I mean, this childish demand for liberation. They don't want to do their duty, as Robert E. Lee would say. They don't want to understand the world as it is. They want liberation from all these things that are in place to help them discipline themselves. They don't want to understand the world like Obama. Everyone should be able to vote. Well, are we liberated yet if we have under 18-year-olds who aren't allowed to vote? I mean, why isn't it, there's no natural stopping point to this. Either you use your head to reason correctly, and you use experience to check what your reasoning comes up with, or you live in the world of fantasy with these crazy leftists and hate-filled Jews. We want a world characterized by fairness, equity, and justice, and free strawberries. We want a world that works well for everyone. We believe that we can have such a world. Making that happen means the elimination of unearned privilege for members of any group, particularly the allocation of such privilege on the basis of presumed membership in particular social identity groups. You know, what does all this mean? Well, it's very hazy, but you can sure as hell hear someone saying, reciting it to you through a loudspeaker as you're lined up against the wall to be shot as a class enemy. That's what it sounds like to me. It sounds like Mao's China. You know, or Vietnam, or you've got glasses. That's an example of you're a member of the class of that benefits from unearned privilege, or a kulak, or a rich peasant being rounded up and shot by Jews in Lenin's Russia. That's what it sounds like to me. That's what this, it sounds like ethereal, airy-fairy, and then when the Rush Limbaughs make fun of this stuff, they make fun of it, but it's not funny because it results in people being killed. One thing about Christian Science, it's non-dogmatic. They don't kill anybody. They don't force you to believe what they want. Even if you go to church and you go to doctors, they don't really care. It's totally non-dogmatic. But this kind of leftist fantasy world is utterly dogmatic. Wherever they have power, they completely prevent anyone from going against them. And then they round up the evil classes, which today is white males,
and they kill them off. So don't for a second think because this is foolish, it isn't dangerous. The focus this year is on clarifying slash describing and creating practice slash praxis that focuses on where we are going, liberation, than where we are coming from, oppression, white privilege. On what we want, liberation, rather than what we don't want, white privilege, white supremacy, oppression. This year we acknowledge that we study white privilege not to learn more about white privilege, rather to see what it can teach us about liberation. The focus of our fight is more and more for something and less against something. Blah, blah, blah. I don't really find that very plausible. 2008 White Privilege Conference appreciates the following sponsors. And America and More LLC, Association of Independent Schools in New England. These are the same crazies who were the abolition fanatics who hated white Southerners. Committee for Racial Justice in Toronto. Conference, the United Church of Canada. Continuing Education and Professional Development Program at Rutgers University School of Social Work. Evangelical Church of America, Food for Thought Books, T.R. Taylor Consulting Group, Star King School for Ministry, Social Justice Fund Northwest, Social Justice Department of the Episcopal Church in the USA. Those are a lot of rich punks who cause problems in the U.S. with their ideology. Isn't that great, though, that this Jewish broad Ferber, I'm assuming she's a Jew named Abby Ferber, is head of the Matrix Center for the Advancement of Social Equity and Inclusion. I mean, my God, you talk about the Matrix you want to be unplugged from. So this has support from not a huge amount of corporate stuff like the anthropology thing does, but from the left-wing churches, left-wing political groups, and all kinds of colleges. NYU, Center for Multicultural Education and Programs. And special thanks to Trader Joe's, National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, Williston Northampton School, Whole Foods, Staples. These are organizations that are kicking in money to them, Collective Copies, and many more that I haven't read. And they're actually, this is funny now, looking at their table, they're actually having a Shabbat dinner to emphasize that they are not, that we have to be hospitable to non-Christian religions. Well, basically it's more of an anti-Christian thing than it is a pro-Jew or a pro-Muslim thing. And this goes on for, they have all kinds of film screenings and workshops, and it goes on Thursday. Let's see, they're up from 11 to 12:30, 3:15 to 4:45. So they have, you know, 3-4 hours a day where they go to these workshops, and then they bitch and moan, and they listen to lectures, and they go see some films, and then they go out and party, or they go have tuna tacos at night, and then they do it all for 2 or 3 or 4 days, basically on your and my dime. That's the sad part of it. I mean, they're not being hosted for free. And you've got, you know, a hearty mix of human trail mix of lesbians and Jews and blacks and really limp-wristed white men who are either fags or they're just pathetic. There will not be a great number of normal people at this conference, let's put it that way. There will be aggrieved freaks in great number. I think you can well believe that. aggrieved freaks in great numbers. There's also a band back in the 80s. I can't find any of their MP3s yet. Let's see. Now, I'm just going to read you because this stuff is remarkable. And you know what? Their next year, their show is in Memphis. Maybe I'll have to sneak down there. That's probably 5 or 6 hours and listen to some of their talks. I enjoy a little taste of craziness now and then. Let's see what they got here. I wonder if they're covered by the media at all. But they have some of these, I'm not really particularly well-versed in whiteness studies, but I know a little. I've had people send me a book or two, and I've read some. I think Dietrich gave me his own book from one of his college classes. And there's a handful of authors who are fairly well-known. One is Joe Fagan, And Matt Newkey and I wrote a review of his book, Oi, back when VNN first started, and I recently relinked that on VNNforum.com. He's basically a Marxist. He wrote a book about how the Irish became white, and that's a big theme of this, that whiteness is a social construct. I still don't know what the hell that means any more than I know what white privilege means, but it's basically an attempt to claim that, like, the white race is not what it appears to be, you know, a type of person that tends to act in certain ways. It's something that you can either be white or not be white, and at one point these things were considered white, and then they weren't. It's basically a bunch of lies. There might be very small little things that it's built mountains out of them, you know, but no. The Irish were always regarded as white. The Italians were regarded as white. Greeks were regarded as white. They just lie about that. There's always been a very sharp distinction made between those groups and niggers or Mexicans or so-called, miscalled Native Americans or Chinese or Jews. There's always been sharp distinctions made between those. And they know that, but, you know, lying doesn't stop them. Now, I don't know if Fagan is at this conference, but another big guy is Francis E. Kendall, seems to be one of the main ones. He's written a book. He's talking about understanding white privilege. A couple other names I recognize. There's probably four or five of these. I don't know how many whiteness studies. I remember we looked that up a few years ago, and there was something like, I don't know, maybe 35 whiteness studies programs around the country. I'm not sure how many there are. I will find that and talk about it on future shows, but basically, this is the kind of conference that would come out of that bogus academic discipline that is spreading soon to a university near you. I see they have one of their sessions is on a complex positionality, Jews, whiteness, and identity. Complex. The Jews want to be very in the moment. Whatever is good for the Jews is what they're going to be. Do they need to be white? They'll be white. Do they need to be non-white? They'll be non-white. You know, that's what you call complex positionality. One thing they'll never be is the people who brought the slaves over here in their slave ships, at least not in the history books, if they can help it. The role of listening and emotional healing and ending racism with Rachel Noble and Veronica LaCrue. And what you get a lot of these things, and I've had, you know, girlfriends who were kind of leftist, and I know this mentality, and you know they're a bunch of crybabies who are not interested in facts, and they need what they never get, and they need a strong male, masculine, logical, rational, linear mind to explain to them where they're wrong, and that can lead some of these women back into the right track. But if they go down this craziness track far enough, they're pretty much lost, and there's nothing you can do with them. In fact, the one girl I was talking about went on and got a PhD in, I don't know, I think politics or women's studies, and I'm sure she still thinks like this because she was leading one of these women's collectives, of which there are tens of thousands. You can just imagine what kind of stuff you're going to hear in the role of listening and emotional healing and ending racism. You're going to hear a bunch of broads. They're not going to use any facts. They're going to tell how they feel about this, that, or the other, and how they had something happened to them, and they had a racist thought, and then how they really thought about that and rethought about it, and blah, 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 and how they're, you know, it just never ends, and there's no value to it. You can see why civilization was built by white males, as much by what they're not interested in as what they are interested in. They don't go in for that kind of garbage. Communicating about race and white privilege using critical humility. Experiential workshop. That's from the European American Collaborative Challenging Whiteness. So they're going to get really humble. And, you know, they're going to try to relearn how to be humans instead of being whites. Or maybe the one guy said they're going to be white, but you can be a different kind of white. A white who puts blacks and browns and others first, and we call it social justice. Understanding Whiteness, Unraveling Racism, Lori Lippin, Stephanie Puentes, and Heather Young. 7 to 9 p.m. They have film screenings. Let's see, what do they have? Wednesday from 7 to 9, they have White Privilege 101, Getting in on the Conversation. And I'm wondering how many of these movies can be torrented, maybe stuck on Podblock. We can link to them at vnnforum.com because they have a lot of little films that they're showing at this White Privilege 101, and I will look some of these up and see if I can locate them. Consists of personal interviews with keynote speakers, workshop presenters, and participants from the White Privilege Conference. The video is organized according to three sections. Definition: what is white privilege? Examples: what are some examples of white privilege? And action: what can I do about white privilege? And then they have a circle of women. Oh my God. The menses will flow. The mental equivalent of menses will flow in that. Believe me, you don't want to be anywhere near there. The candid women featured in this video are illuminating. They enhance our appreciation of the range of women's experiences across a category such as age, race, ethnicity, tightness or slackness of vagina, and other bodily parts. Therein lies perhaps Circle of Women's greatest gift. It's demonstration to all women that they are not alone in their struggles to relate positively to their bodies. Oh my freaking Jesus. Keep me away from that. And then, of course, they have a film, Banished, that's going to, you know, a new film from California Newsreel, which is generating much discussion. Vividly recovers the too quickly forgotten history of racial cleansing in America when thousands of African Americans were driven from their homes and communities by violent racist mobs. You know, of course, they don't tell you about violent racist mobs today going after white people in America. They're not really interested in that. Facilitators, Katya Hahn. Every Katya I've ever heard of is a goddamn leftist. And this, I mean, this stuff has really crept in there. I mean, Katya Hahn, lecturer, social justice education at UMass Amherst. I mean, what kind of bogus stuff is that? That's like some official discipline, social justice education. It's like, all that stuff is like, it's almost like a form of self-praise. You know, the name of a discipline should be neutral. It shouldn't be like, I am in the sight of the gods. Like, social justice has some real objective meaning that's positive. And then they got some little kike named Zoe Greenberg's Bat Mitzvah Project. She created Enough, a kid's perspective. Enough takes on the taboo subjects of wealth, poverty, and class. Sprightly young Jewess interviews with class and race diverse young people throughout Philadelphia. Zoe reveals what we are and aren't saying about class and why it matters. This professional quality short film is a great conversation starter for audiences of all ages to explore class and classism in the United States. The film is a recipient of the Princeton Prize in Race Relations for 2007 in Philadelphia, a contest that seeks to recognize and support and encourage the young people of our country who have demonstrated a commitment to advancing the cause of relations among the races. You see how the Jews groom their own. They give them prizes. They set them up. These are the kind of films that they're going to be showing here. That's only the films on one day. Then we have Karate Chops, Geishas, Nerds, and the Asian Invasions, Reflections of a Korean Adopted American. That's great. Challenging the Myth of the Model Minority. That's a workshop. Does Huck Finn belong in your classroom? Battling White Supremacy in the English Curriculum. Critical Liberation Theory, Racism in the Mental Health Field. And, I mean, this goes on and on and on and on. Radical White Identity and Community. Building Capacity for Sustainable Anti-Racist Work in White Communities. Claire Robbins and Sarah Glassband. They have something called AWARE, and it's out of L.A., AWARE-LA. They're a model of racial white identity and community. First Steps to Building an Active Community of White Anti-Racist People, dedicated to racial justice work alongside people of color. How does radical white community challenge white supremacy and also contradict the idea that white people working together is always problematic? Fucking believable. This workshop will explore these questions in an interactive and experiential way. Great. Oh, yeah, then we got the sex deviants. Trans access and gendered spaces. You know, and I'm only on page 14 out of 48, and this stuff goes on and on and on and on and on. 16, I'm trying to find if there's anything more representative worth talking about. Do have one interesting thing here. They have Real Bad Arabs, featuring acclaimed author Dr. Jack Shaheen. And I've heard of this. This is a history of anti-Arab portrayals in Jew-owned media that is Hollywood. I don't know how anti-Jew the film is, but I've heard of this movie before. The film explores a long line of degrading images of Arabs, from Bedouin bandits and submissive maidens to sinister sheiks and gun-wielding terrorists. Along the way, offering devastating insights into the origin of these stereotypic images, their development at key points in U.S. history, and why they matter so much today. Shaheen shows how the persistence of these images over time has served to naturalize prejudicial attitudes towards Arabs and Arab culture. Well, you know, why couldn't you say the same thing? And what that is true, but why couldn't you say the same thing about whites? Through the stereotypes of the dumb blonde, the inbred redneck, the evil frat boy, the corrupt military and police, the evil corporate fat cat, all these are images deliberately created and maintained by the Jew. And Ben Stein talks about this in The View from Sunset Boulevard, which I wrote a long review of when VNN began. The Jew deliberately portrays the groups he wishes to destroy negatively, and never departs from his stereotypes of them. Never. That's why pop culture is not only poisonous, it's boring. Because you only get one set of stereotypes, because one set of stereotypes serves the Jewish agenda. Now, I don't know if this Shaheen film at all talks about the Jewish reason for the portrayal of Arabs that way, but it would be an interesting film to watch. And white filmmakers could make something along the same lines. Here's something that raised a question in my mind because I don't know too much about it, but Jawanza Kanjufu will be talking about an African-centered response to Ruby Payne's poverty theory. Ruby Payne has become, who I have never heard of before, Ruby Payne, spelled as sounds, has become very popular with white educators of African-American children. Her work essentially concludes that for students who are not white and middle income, it will be very difficult to reach full potential. Because they don't have full potential. Makes me wonder if it's a way to subtly acknowledge that. I'll look around for that. I've never heard of Ruby Payne before. Keep your eyes on the prize, the role of song in critical liberation practices. Song can be used to construct powerful individual and collective identities and communicate urgency to act in the face of oppressive practices. This performative analysis examines the potential for song to support critical liberation practice among youth and adults. Critical liberation practice. Jesus H. Christ. It sounds like it's right out of an East German book. Oh, yeah, see, they do have Joe Fagan there. He's one of the big names. He and Ignatieff are two of the biggest names. I think they may have co-founded Race Trader, the magazine. Or maybe it was just Ignatieff, but I think it might have been both of them. Yeah, they have all these buzzwords. United to end racism, the role of white people in ending racism. This workshop puts particular attention on the role that white people can play in ending white racism. White people are set up to play an oppressive role in our society, and it's critical that we get to reclaim our own goodness and intelligence as we get an opportunity to face our challenges, confusions, fears, and hopes when it comes to eliminating racism. This workshop introduces the tools of listening and focusing attention on these challenges through the tools of re-evaluation, capital R and E, counseling, re-evaluation counseling as a method for enhancing our progress. And all this stuff is like, basically it's self-brainwashing. Teaching yourself to reinterpret common sense conclusions suggested by everyday evidence and transmuting them into the appropriate ideological response. If you understand what I mean, and I'm not entirely sure you do. But it's basically retraining yourself not to see things as they are, but as they should be. And we here are doing the opposite. We are Radio Istina. The opposite of Istina is Pravda. Pravda is the real truth, that is the lie, the noble truth, the ideological truth. Istina is the factual reality of the situation. So we are Istina to this white privilege conference's Pravda. Now they say, leading while white, increasing your ability to address racism and white privilege in your organization. Leading While White will offer tools to help participants understand themselves and their lives as white people, recognize the impact and ramifications of their personal behaviors on people of color and other whites, and enhance their skills in working with other white leaders to create work environments that are hospitable for all people. And again, more talk about developing a community of white anti-racists. What are the pitfalls you should avoid? What are the processes and philosophies that are essential to success? Culturally responsive K-12 classroom practice. Remember, all your kid is going to be subject to a lot of these if you put them in a public school. You know, cracking, you know, we see more dogma. Cracking the codes of internalized racial oppression and internalized racial supremacy. So these are terms that they just have recourse to. Well, they never leave them. They speak almost wholly in this jargon or ideological codes so that reality and common words don't intrude very much. It's almost, they could almost conduct a discussion wholly in codes. You know, we're just kind of going through this together. I am not, as I said, I am not completely versed in this. In order to explain the whole background and the origins of it, I can just tell you it's a more recent form of the what you had in the 60s was blacks violently took over campuses and issued demands that were later met by groveling college administrators, and those demands included setting up black studies departments. Well, 30, 40 years later, they not only are black and Chicano and Asian, well, now they're adding white to it. But, of course, it can't be an honest study of white people because, well, that would be what I'm doing. It has to be a negative study. Whites are an inherently a historically negative people. And the only way they can escape this evil is by re-somethinging or re-25 different things until they become effectively Jewish, making Jewish communists of themselves. The better to aid Jews and the mud community that is 92% of the world. You know, whereas an honest white studies might say, look, 8% of the world has produced basically 100% of the technologies and philosophy and art that the world lives by, and medicine. So whites are kind of the all-stars of this sad globe, is how a real whiteness studies would look at it. But they don't look at it that way at the White Privilege Conference starting later today in Amherst, Massachusetts. I tell you what, why don't we wrap it up right about there? And all of the stuff I've talked about today, you can find links to at vnnforum.com. And we try to give you a complete grounding in the history of your people, the origin of humans, and where Europeans came from. How they evolved, how they got to America, what they did in America. And it's all stuff that you're not going to get in public schools. You're going to get the reverse of the truth. Because our race, frankly, is hated. And frankly, it's hated for being superior. And only here at Radio Istina will you get the actual truth about what's going on. And so I'm going to play a couple more songs and we'll wrap it up there. We've gone about, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours, somewhere in that range. And I think that well, let me see, what have we got? Probably got a couple more songs here I haven't played. Did I play? I did. I played all the ones I got the other day. I found a good little tool for recording these. Yeah, let's see. Let's look at a different one. I'll play three more songs, and first I'm going to play Where Does the Good Go by Tegan and Sarah. And then I'll add two more, and then I'll come back on and close it.
Where do you go with your broken heart and soul? And what do you do with the left over you? And how do you know when to let go? Where does the good go? Where does the good go?
When it comes to loving me, she's Father of mine, tell me where have you been? You know I just closed my eyes, my whole world disappeared. Father of mine, take me back to the day. Yeah, when I was still your golden boy, back before you went away. I remember blue skies walking the block. I loved it when you held me high, I loved to hear you talk. You would take me to the movies, you would take me to the beach, take me to a place inside that is so hard to reach. Father of mine, tell me where did you go? Yeah, you had the world inside your hands, but you did not seem to know. Father, what do you see when you look back at your wasted life and you don't see me? I was 10 years old, doing all that I could. Wasn't easy for me to be a scared white boy in a black neighborhood. Sometimes you would send me a birthday card with a $5 bill. Then I never understood what you did, and I guess I never will.
All right, that was Everclear's best song, Father of Mine, and probably the best modern song to address. Pretty common social happening. Everclear, Father of Mine. Before that, we had Cat Stevens, First Cut is the Deepest. Before that, we had Tegan and Star, Where Does the Good Go? And that'll do it for today, April 2nd, 2008. I am Alex Linder. The show is Radio Istina. And we'll be back before long, and thanks for listening to us this morning. Good day.